So, Casey, what trackpad are you using?
Look at the show notes, Marco. I saw you using the show notes. There is a time and a place for me to talk about my computer.
So, Casey, what OS are you using?
I will say that I did not downgrade, and there are reasons. There are reasons. Most of them came from, I think it was a post-show conversation between the three of us, where I was convinced not to do it yet. But I don't want to talk about that yet.
So who's going over to kick you?
Yeah, I don't know. That's up to you guys.
Hey, give me one moment. I have to go turn the air conditioning on because it's super hot in here. One second.
Remember when Marco said he's going to hang out above 77 degrees in his beach house? I remember that.
Mm-hmm. I remember that too.
Yeah, it's going to turn on the air conditioning? All right. What the hell temperature is it over there? I just jammed my mouse cursor into the lower left corner to try to get dashboard to come up.
Because
I wanted to see what the weather was. So it was just instinctive. What temperature is it? Mouse goes into lower left corner. Nothing happens.
Yeah, it's 46 degrees, but it's a hot room. And
yeah, you need that AC. You're right. Get that on.
Yeah.
Immediately.
Let's start, as we must do, with some follow-up. We had some really genuinely great feedback with regard to Radar and Feedback Assistant, and my particular feedback with regard to my Catalina woes, which we'll get to in just a moment. According to a couple of different people, I believe, feedback or feedbacks is, I guess, the plural of them. Those get turned into radars internally. So Feedback Assistant, which is what, you know, the peons like the three of us would use to file a bug, those are their own bucket of things. Those are the feedbacks. And then internal to Apple, they get turned into radars. And so one of the other things that we had asked about either on Twitter or perhaps here on the show is, I think one of you guys, in fact, brought it up last week, that you could do RDAR:// and then a radar number, and that on an Apple-owned computer would give the person a hyperlink directly into Radar to that direct ticket. And according to anonymous people, those links do still work, but the feedback number is different from the radar number. Feedbacks generate a radar when they're submitted, and they get handled internally as the radar. The feedback number is in a field of the radar, so you can search for or track an issue by feedback number or radar number, but if you're linking to it with RDAR:// you have to use the radar number. And this one particular individual added, I think the idea is that this lets the radar get handled internally as a radar without worrying about confidential information getting transmitted back to the user. I'm not sure about how or when things get transmitted back to Feedback Assistant or the user.
That sounds worse than the old system. We're even farther removed from the actual, like, you know, mm-hmm. before we threw things into this web thing that went into this bucket that got viewed by a native app. Now we're in this native app that throws things into a bucket that goes into another bucket that gets viewed by the real. and then they don't even know if I do something in Radar, how does that propagate back to the customers? So disconnected. It's like kind of like a software developer's relationship with their customers in the app store. Very distant.
I love that you're now one of us. Like, after all this time.
I know.
It's like when you got an iPhone, like 15 years after the iPhone was released, like you finally joined the club. Like,
I got an iPod Touch on day one. Just same thing, no phone calls. And it was faster, damn it. It was faster.
Yeah, that very first one. It had like a slightly mm-hmm. higher clocked CPU, right?
It did.
It's like 10% and it faster or something.
It was thinner and faster. It was obviously better. Who needs to make phone calls?
Oh, my word. All right. So let's talk about Casey's computer corner. I know that during the main part of the show that I had said that one of you needs to come to Richmond and kick me if I have not yet downgraded to Mojave. We were discussing before the show, possibly before we went live, who it was that was going to come and kick me because I am still on Catalina. But I have reasons and I have updates. So I will leave it to the two of you to decide who's going to make the trek down to Virginia.
John.
It sounds
John.
Like...
My finger's on my nose. It's John.
I heard Marco's made an automatic kicking machine.
That's true. Well done. So anyway, so speaking of radars and feedbacks and things of that nature, we did get an anonymous update on the radar that was created from the feedback that I had created, complaining and moaning and trying to get fixes for my poor iMac Pro. And so this anonymous person basically... paraphrase, and I'm now paraphrasing the paraphrase, what they had seen in the radar. But if I understand what they said appropriately, and I'm waiting for John to correct me after I make my little spiel here, it's that according to Apple, potentially thread contention on kernel tasks VM map lock to the point that the keyboard and mouse events can't get a lock on this like global queue. I'm pretty confident I butchered that pretty well. John, can you translate that into something that makes more sense?
I didn't read the message with that much level of detail. I think you got the gist of it. Okay. It's just lock contention. Why is there so much contention? I think like that is two things. Why is there so much contention, first of all? And second of all, why does Catalina handle that contention worse than Mojave, apparently?
Yep, and I have no answers for that. But another thing that was said in the radar, according to this anonymous little birdie, is that a bunch of SMB kernel work is to blame. Now, I'm assuming SMB in this context is like Samba, like server message block, whatever it's called, like network shares. And the reason I think that is because the Apple person noted that MDS and BackupD and, more importantly, CrashPlan Service and Plex were all between them spawning a zillion threads, all doing stuff across the network using what I used to call Samba, basically a Windows-style network share to my Synology. And apparently the Apple person called out CrashPlan as being particularly egregious in this department.
I'm shocked.
And so
CrashPlan software might be inefficient.
Who knew? It's so bad. And we're going to talk about that later if you let me. But anyway, it seemed like that was causing some real problems. Now, I agree with you, John. I'm not entirely clear why this is worse in Catalina. Another thing that was mentioned that I didn't copy to the show notes, now I'm going right off the top of my head, is that as cores go up, the amount of things that could be asking for this global lock also goes up. So on an iMac Pro that has, I don't even know how many cores I have, a billion on this iMac Pro, that could actually exacerbate it and make things even worse, which is no bueno. But the reason I didn't downgrade, other than some convincing from Marco and John that, again, I don't think made the released version of the episode, I decided to take a few different strategies. Now, number one, the thing that everyone wanted me to do, which I said I was going to do and then did not do, is try the other trackpad I have. I had lamented, mostly jokingly, that it was all the way up in the attic. I need to go get it, blah, blah, blah. So I went up to the attic the very moment I stopped recording last week to get that other trackpad, that alternate trackpad that came with the iMac Pro. And it was when I got the keyboard and trackpad box back downstairs, or back into the middle floor, if you will, that I opened it up and realized, oh, wait, I got a mouse with this. I forgot. Like a traditional magic mouse. I completely forgot.
Whoops.
Right. I completely forgot. I didn't order a new trackpad because why would I? It seemed like I shouldn't need it. So the reason I didn't try it was because I didn't have an alternate one to try. And I absolutely had planned on and was going to try it. However, things, and let me do a little Foley work and knock on my glass desk very loudly. Things might be looking up. I think.
So you're still using the old trackpad?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Via Bluetooth, I should add. I'm using it via Bluetooth. All right.
Did you just simply stop using CrashPlan?
Well, almost. The first thing, this is terrible, but I'm also overjoyed that it seems to be getting better. So the first thing I did was I started turning off CrashPlan kind of strategically. So when I was really sitting down working at the computer, I turned CrashPlan completely off. And there's a launch control command that you can run in the terminal to turn it off. Now, there are settings within CrashPlan to like be very gingerly. You'll treat the CPU with very soft hands when the user is at the computer, but I don't trust their crap software for anything. So I just freaking turned it off. And that helped some. All right, listeners, here's the thing. The other two aren't listening right now. I'm about to say something that the two of them are going to have a choice, and they can either beat the crap out of me for the next 20 minutes, or they can be sympathetic and understanding. So let's see what happens. Right. So the other thing I did was I took Plex off my computer, which pained me.
Why would we complain about that?
Because this is my world. My world is my media consumption world.
Plex is your world, not running Plex on your Mac. You just have to have Plex running somewhere.
Yeah, you can run it on pretty much anything.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing.
Oh, did you upgrade your Synology?
No. Oh, I want to so badly, but that's a whole different discussion. We should talk about that later. But anyways, it occurred to me that I had this Mac Mini that was just kind of sitting there that I had gotten from Justin at Mac Stadium. And it's old. I don't even remember exactly what vintage it is, but it is more than enough to run Plex. And it was literally sitting there sleeping and idle, just because I wasn't doing anything with it. I really wanted to have it in the house just in case. You never really know why, but I wasn't doing anything with it. And it occurred to me, wait a second, why not run Plex on that? And so I did that. I haven't literally removed it from my iMac Pro, but I have not run it on my iMac Pro in about a week. And I am running it on the Mac Mini. And the moment I made that decision, everything started to feel better. That and the combination of CrashPlan not running, generally speaking, seems to have almost completely fixed my problems, which is both wonderful and deeply depressing.
What is Plex doing that would relate to contention? Or do you have, like, is it in the background making optimized versions? Like, how, like, no. I can understand how it would spawn a bunch of threads. Like, Plex is one of the least demanding uses of network and file resources you can imagine. It's sequential reading, slow sequential reading of very large files, granted, over the network, but it's not like it's like CrashPlan where it's spawning a million threads and trying to read every single file in your file system. It's doing a targeted thing, right?
Well, yes, and I do have Plex looking at my photo library, which I don't think helps because I don't think mine is as big as yours. Oh, God. I don't think my photo library is as big as yours, but I am still sure that that doesn't help much. And also, I do have it scanning like every 15 minutes for new media or whatever the case may be, which is probably not necessary.
No, the new media scan is nothing, but like the photos thing, tell me, I haven't used Plex with photos. What does that entail? Does it crawl in your photos library like periodically to see if there are new photos?
It is. Now, I still take your point, though, John, and I agree with you that it seems odd that moving Plex away from the iMac Pro has made such a big difference, but it seems like it's made a tremendous, tremendous difference. And so that has worked really well. Now, earlier today, I turned CrashPlan on for the first time in a while, and within, I don't know, a couple of minutes of that happening, I got a machine gun trackpad. So I think the next step is, and we're going to talk about this more later, I think the next step is I'm going to move CrashPlan also onto this Mac Mini.
Yeah.
Although at that point, I'm really tempting fate because that Mac Mini is on Catalina. And so maybe I'm just going to move the problem from one computer to another. Who knows?
But you don't need to use the Mac Mini interactively, right?
Mm-hmm. That's the other thing. Is that who really cares? As long as the thing is functioning, yeah, it doesn't really matter. So that is probably the medium-term plan. The long-term plan, which I'd like to get through the rest of follow-up before we discuss it, but the long-term plan is I'd really like to just divorce myself of CrashPlan entirely and find a different mechanism to back up the Synology, because that's really what I'm after with CrashPlan. After having reloaded to, you know, both my laptop and desktop like 44 times in the last 6 months, I've gotten to the point that almost everything that's actually on my computer is relatively ephemeral. I'm sure there are things that are not, but the majority is on GitHub. It's on my Synology. It's, I don't know, in iCloud or something like that. So it seems like it shouldn't be a problem to just, you know, get rid of CrashPlan and not have it backing up the iMac at all. And I do have Time Machine if things really get bad, but in a worst case scenario, screw it. I'll just reinstall everything on the computer from scratch. So my question for later, which I really don't want to get into now, is how do I back up the Synology for less than $100 a month? And I'm saying that only slightly facetiously. But in summary, the Mac Mini has saved my bacon. I really appreciate that Justin had sent it my way, and everything so far seems okay. Now, remind me of that in like 20 minutes when this thing fails miserably. But sitting here now, it all seems all right.
You're narrowing it down like we talked about by removing things from your computer. It's just that you're not removing them temporarily to troubleshoot. You're moving them permanently into another computer that you don't have to use.
And part of the motivation for moving Plex to the Mac Mini was that Plex is the thing that is least ephemeral on my iMac Pro. And the reason I say that is because, yes, all the media is stored on the Synology, literally 100% of it. But the database of what I've watched and where everything is and all of this metadata and all that other garbage isn't stored on the Synology. That was stored on my iMac. And yes, it is backing itself up to the Synology from time to time, but it's just a nightmare it would have been a nightmare to move Plex to another machine out of like haste or angst, you know what I mean? Like when it wasn't on my own terms. And so by having it on this other computer, unless the Mac Mini blows itself up, that leaves me much more flexibility with the iMac to downgrade it or to reinstall Catalina from scratch if I felt like it for some strange reason. You know, now the iMac Pro is much more flexible than it was before. And so, yes, you're right. It's not a temporary thing with regard to Plex anyway, but having Plex on its own basically dedicated device has really freed up a lot of the stress in my world with regard to the iMac Pro.
One more thing about Plex from my troubleshooting with sleep-wake stuff. Plex is not great about – this is a – if you search the web for this, you'll find it's a bug that they supposedly fixed in the past, but it's still not great about it. It will grab power assertions that keep your – not only keep your computer from going to sleep, but even keep your screen from like going into the screensaver or dimming or switching off. Which, you know, it'll grab them when you ask it to play video, if you ever ask it to play video locally, but then it just will not give them up a lot of the time. Like, you won't be actually playing any video, but because you had previously paid video, if you look at PMSet, you'll see that Plex has a power assertion that prevents the screen from even dimming, and it's the worst, because I'll walk by the downstairs of the house, and I'll say, what is that light coming from that room? Because all the lights are out, and I'll look in there, and I'll see that, you know, the IMAX screen has been on full brightness for the past 2 hours on the same screen because something grabbed power assertion, and it's always Plex. So Plex, if you're out there and listening, let go of your power assertions when you're not playing video. And people, if you have this happening to you, Plex may be the culprit. The way to fix it is just to quit the Plex server and restart it, and then it doesn't have the power assertion anymore, but it's still an annoying bug.
No argument. All right, tell me, John, about the Pegasus J2i, please.
That's my $400 piece of bent metal that holds hard drives that I shoved into my computer. I had it on my desk for a while. I had it on my desk last week. On the weekend, I got some time to open up the computer to do it. This is my second time now opening up the computer. I'm still terrible at it. I think this design of getting at the internals, once you have the thing off, it's great because you have access on all sides to the internals. Getting it off, not so great. I'm bad at it, but B, it is harder. It is way harder than popping the side off of an old cheese grater. It's harder than opening the door on a Yosemite or El Cap plastic tower case. It is physically difficult thing to do because there's a lot of friction pulling the thing off, and if you are not pulling exactly straight, it doesn't come up. All right, and it's especially difficult because mine is on this sort of little table thingy that is lower than a desk, but higher than the floor. So there is a little bit of awkwardness of trying to lift the thing up. But anyway, that aside, I was all ready to install the thing. And my first problem was that somehow I don't have a T8 Torx driver in the house. I have T6 and T, you know, and all the sizes around it, T3. I didn't have a T8, so I had to go out and get another tool, which was kind of annoying. But beyond that, installation went fairly well. My only real complaint is that they give you like a cable to connect to the power and the two SATA ports. You know, on the motherboard, there's a power connector and then two SATA ports, and then there's the big SATA cables that go to the actual drives. And they make a single bundle of ribbon cables that, you know, supposed to fulfill that role. And they tape, it's this, like this bundle of interleaved ribbon cables, they tape them together, right? You would think, great, they know exactly which computer this is going in. They know where all the parts are on the motherboard. They know where the ports are going to be on the hard drives. This cable should be an exact fit. But it is not. It's not an exact fit. It, like, for starters, if you look at the parts that plug into the drive, they are exactly level with each other. It's like, the drives are top and bottom. They're not side by side. You can't have these things be exactly level. Like, doesn't make any sense. One of the drives is going to be higher than the other. Therefore, one of the connectors has to have a longer ribbon cable on it. Otherwise, either one's not going to reach or one's going to be buckled. Second, the connectors on the motherboard are horizontal. Like, it's the two SATA connectors and the power connector. They're in a line horizontally. But the things that plug in there are not three different lengths to go into things that are three different distances. They're all the same length. So I had to untape some of the tape that they had used to tape together this bundle of wires just to try to get it so the things would plug in without kinking too much. I talked to Stephen Hackett. He said, yeah, he did the same thing. He had to remove the tape. So, you know, I guess you get what you pay for only $400 for a bent piece of metal. You know, they can't bother making the ribbon cable be the right length. Oh, and by the way, it's, you know, $400 for a bent piece of metal. I say that because that's all I wanted was the bent piece of metal, but it did come with an 8 terabyte hard drive. So that's where some of the cost is. An 8 terabyte hard drive, retail value, $134, or whatever the hell it is. Anyway, now I've got a big hard drive in my computer. I ordered another hard drive to fill the other bay just because I wanted one a little bit bigger than the other ones I have laying around. So I'm doing that. I don't like having a big, noisy, spinning hard drive inside my otherwise quiet computer, so I keep it unmounted and spun down. Those two things are not synonymous with this computer and Catalina, perhaps surprisingly. When I wake my computer from sleep, the hard drive spins up, even if it's not mounted, and it stays spinning, even though it continues.
You must love that.
Even though it continues to be not mounted, it's an easy fix. You can just mount it and then unmount it, and then it spins down. And this is all this is to say is I can definitely hear when the hard drive is spinning. Forget about accessing; nothing is accessing it. The drive is unmounted. There is no, you know, hard drive heads moving back and forth, but it's spinning, and I can hear that. The solution to that, or one of the solutions that I came up with, is this handy application called Mountain, which I've had for ages. I used to use to mount and unmount my, at one time, 4 internal drives on my old cheese grater. And one of the features that Mountain has, it's on the Mac App Store, but I bought it from the website because anything that deals with hardware, I figure if there's going to be some feature that can't implement, it'll be in the Mac App Store version. So buy direct, gives the developer more money, and potentially has more features. Anyway, there is a setting that there are many settings in Mountain, one of which is, hey, when this drive is unmounted, spin it down. Or when I wake from sleep and it's not mounted, spin it down. Like, there's a whole bunch of options about what you should do when you eject it, what you should do when you wake from sleep. And lo and behold, just put that setting. And now when I wake my computer up, the hard drive spins up, reminding me of my old 10-year-old cheese grater making some noises of things spinning up, and then immediately spins down back to blessed, not quite silence. So mostly thumbs up on the ridiculously expensive Pegasus J2i. Big thumbs up for Mountain, although I don't like the menu bar icon. It could be better. But anyway, other than that, I am headed towards having many, many terabytes of internal storage, and soon I will be very happy.
All right. Darren Rogers had some feedback with regard to shorter certificate expiration, which we had talked about last week. Darren writes, the shorter expirations also helps ensure that everyone, for a reasonable value of the term, is using the latest standards and best practices for their certificates. A concrete example would be the certificate transparency and SCT, signed certificate timestamp. Any cert you get today should have an SCT, but that hasn't always been true, so there are many websites without them. The very nature of SCTs is such that they will mostly be useful when everyone has them and browsers can start requiring them. Until then, they are of nominal value. So this shorter expiration kind of forces everyone to embrace the latest and greatest quicker than it would otherwise. Additionally, Chris Thompson writes, you're right about certificate revocation not being very effective currently, and that an attacker having a year to use a compromised cert is still bad. That said, browsers still do use bundled revocation lists to cache a set of revocations. By constraining the max certificate lifetime, that means you can potentially clear out the expired certificates, and this will take up less bandwidth, storage, memory, etc. Secondly, with long-lived certs, it becomes very hard to make important security changes to TLS certificates. For example, when SHA-1 signatures support was removed in browsers after increasing evidence that collisions were feasible. But if certs last up to 5 years, you can't just turn it off or set a reasonable cutoff point. Instead, browsers are stuck with a potentially half a decade-long deprecation window to avoid breaking the web, which is no fun.
Yes, by the way, if any developers are listening who don't read any security things, SHA-1 is super-duper broken. Don't use it for anything remotely related to security.
Yeah, pretty much any hash that you would have worked with in 2006 in PHP or whatever is probably broken at this point.
MD5, if you don't know, for many, many years has been broken in this way. SHA-1 in the past couple of years has been super duper broken in this way. So there you have it.
And then a friend of the show, Ben Thompson of Stratechery, wrote with regard to, I think it was an Ask ATP question, when do you go to Apple Notes, when do you go to a flat file, et cetera, et cetera. And Ben wrote, there's absolutely middle ground between notes, store everything in an inaccessible database, but it syncs, and plain text files. Ben writes, I use Notational Velocity on the desktop, or more accurately, NVAlt, which has a setting to store notes as plain text files in the location of your choice. At the same time, NVAlt uses SimpleNote as the syncing service, which gets me all of my notes on the web or on iOS. So I have the best of both worlds, sync and plain text access / backup. I do at times wish for Notes app rich functionality, particularly in terms of embedding photos and whatnot, but I consider easy access to my data and availability on any computing platform to be table stakes for any data that I want on a permanent basis. We don't have it in the show notes, but Ben had said something about how, he understands the trade-off with regard to using SimpleNote as the syncing service, so he doesn't put anything like super sensitive or private or whatever into any of these notes. But it was an interesting approach to get a middle of the road, like he said.
Yeah, there was another story that flew by recently, although I think it was a repeat of the same story from maybe a year or so ago, about the security of quote-unquote encrypted notes in the Apple Notes app. It uses a database behind the scenes, and apparently, you know how like when you're looking through your notes, the notes are represented in the list by basically the first line in the note. And when you encrypt a note, Apparently that first line is still visible in some data store or somewhere. Anyway, if you're relying on the security of your notes such that no one, you know, if you take a note and then encrypt it and then someone grabs your Mac and runs a bunch of forensic tools and finds the SQLite database and rummages through it, they may be able to find snippets of unencrypted data from that note, which is kind of bad, but, you know, probably not the end of the world. All that to say is if you have something that you really care about the security of, it's best to actually use a security-focused application to store it rather than just an app that is like a notes app. It also happens to have an encrypt feature.
And then finally, Sathish Polio writes, I really enjoyed the segment where you talked about using hyphenated words. It made me realize how much more I need to learn about the English language. I found this helpful and wanted to pass it along. And this is a link to developers.google.com, which is a post called Just Enough Grammar.
Yeah, well, these things are great. Like, sort of, they're not trying to teach you everything. English language is ridiculous and huge and has all sorts of strange things. But you just need a little bit. You just need enough to know what you don't know. Because then, on a case by case basis, when you're writing, if you're aware of sort of the lay of the land, like you come across some construct in your writing, you're like, I don't know what to write here, but I know this is an area of frequent problems, or there is an issue here, or that this is something I should pay attention to. At that point, you're armed with enough knowledge to just go Google the answer. Okay, in this exact sentence structure with this exact word, what am I supposed to do? If you don't know that, if you don't have like that just enough grammar baseline, you won't even know that there's a thing to know there. And you'll just, you know, if you don't know hyphens exist or what they might be used for, you'll just never think about them. If you know they're used kind of in this context for this reason, when you're writing, you may come across something and be like, wait a second, is that one of those places I use hyphens? You're not going to know the answer. You know, it's always going to be tricky. There's all sorts of special cases and everything, but at least you know that it's a thing. So this Just Enough Grammar page and similar sort of crash courses for the basics of grammar, very often focused on like tech writing, just so you can like write sensible, coherent documentation for your code even. It's well worth the effort to just, you know, Get just enough knowledge to be dangerous. I would say just enough knowledge to know what to Google, because that's all you need. No one really knows all these answers except for, you know, some, you know, very obscure book editor who's been doing it a million years. All you got to know is what to Google.
We are sponsored this week by Collide. This is a wonderful software as a service startup called Collide, K-O-L-I-D-E, and it's working to solve security challenges for tech companies that run large Mac fleets and use Slack. So I bet this is some of our listeners out there. So in the world of Mac management, the current accepted practice is to buy an MDM and then use it to lock down everyone's devices. So users can only do, quote, safe things. And the result of this is that your users become frustrated. They don't understand why you don't trust them. They don't understand why their device's features and capabilities are turned off. It's really annoying. Do this often enough, and they'll start just using their personal devices to actually get their work done because they don't get in the way. Collide is different. Collide believes that end-user education about device security is the top priority. So instead of locking down the devices, Collide allows you to monitor them continuously to see if they're compliant with your security policy. And if any device isn't, Collide can message that employee via Slack and walk them through the policy, why it's important, and give them precise instructions on how to fix the issue themselves. And they can even message the user the instant they fix the problem so the user knows they did it right. And they do all this by using an endpoint agent called OS Query, which is 100% open source, doesn't degrade the performance of your Macs, and provides important information to security analysts without violating your end user's privacy. So see for yourself with a first 30 days free across all your devices, including Windows and Linux. See for yourself at collide.com. That's K-O-L-I-D-E. So Collide with a K, K-O-L-I-D-E.com. That's your first 30 days free across all your devices. Thank you so much to Collide for sponsoring our show.
How do you back up a Synology? And the reason I ask is we had talked just a little while ago about CrashPlan and how I really, really don't like it. But the advantage of CrashPlan is that it is $10 a month for one computer for whatever plan I'm on right now. $10 a month for me to back up. I think my backup set is something like 13 terabytes right now. Now, admittedly, that backup set includes the iMac Pro. Admittedly, that backup includes a bunch of stuff on the Synology that I could probably pare down and weed out. And so I looked before the show. I was doing a little preparation because I'm allowed, because I'm not John. And it turns out my media folder on my Synology, which is the thing I care most about, or at least the thing I think I care most about, is 8 terabytes of the 13 terabytes. So I was looking at, you know, what are my options for backing up the Synology? And the most obvious one, the one that everyone recommends, and for good reason, because everything I've read is that it's excellent, is Backblaze B2. So this is their, you know, bigger, longer term, if I understand it right, you know, storage that's really for this kind of a use. You know, it's designed to compete with a bunch of stuff that's of similar vein, right? You know, you're just going to put something away for a long time and probably not need to restore anything from it, if ever, or not frequently, you know, if you do at all. And I was looking at it, well, and the thing of it is that Backblaze B2 is $70 a month for 13 terabytes. A month! It's $40 a month for 8 terabytes. And these are all, you know, rough estimations, or, you know, give or take a bit. But that means it would take me like 3.5 years of B2 to break even with just buying a whole new Synology, filling it with drives, and then moving this one to like my dad's house or something like that, which is, you know, far enough away that it's, you know, not anywhere close, and just mirroring the darn Synology from here to there. And this is kind of a call for recommendations from the listeners and from the two of you.
Hey, what about us?
Yeah. What is one do with this? Like, and the other thing I've heard decent about is Glacier, I think it's called, from Amazon.
Okay.
Well, this is what I want to know. And the other thing is,
oh, Glacier's terrible.
Well, so the other priority I have is I want something that's as close to turnkey as possible. And that B2 very much counts as, because B2 is built into the Synology software. And I can just say, hey, please back yourself up to B2 now. And if I'm willing to throw money at this problem, which I'm getting ever more willing to do, then that is an acceptable answer and a very easy answer. But what am I not considering? Like, should I just pony up literally $3,000 to, you know, bring a new version of my current Synology into my house and move this one to dad's house? Or is there something else I'm just not thinking of?
Well, we had this long discussion last time about how maybe you don't need all that media.
Yeah.
You don't need to be storing might be able to access through streaming services and so on and so forth. Like, I really feel like, especially, you mentioned, like, this is the media I think I care about the most, but it's not really. I know you spend a long time organizing everything, and it's good to have a collection, but you care so much more about your family photos than you do about any of that media, right?
Well, that's a subset of that 8 terabytes, but yes, what you just said is accurate.
Right, but it's a tiny amount. It's less than a terabyte of that is photos.
I think it's about a terabyte, but still, I'm quibbling over minor things. Your point is still completely fair.
Yeah, so one way to save money is to...
not back that up.
No, don't back it up, but, like, decide what part of it you really want to back up, right? So I feel like the most important thing is the metadata in the database, the Plex database, which is tiny, right? That, you know, any organization you've done, any custom poster images you've done, maybe your, like, your watch counts or your progress, or, like, you know, that is the stuff that you've invested time in dealing with, right? The actual media files behind the scenes, if they disappeared, you can probably replace them, right?
Many yes. of them, at least.
Right. Some of it, yeah, but yeah, not
and
all
so
of it.
And what I would do is I would choose what subset of that you actually want to back up. If you want to save money, I feel like you could cut your storage in half just by being judicious about which media do I want to back up versus which media do I not want to back up. And that would involve having to categorize things in some way, or, like, I know it's annoying, but, like, that's a lot of data. And if you're going to have somebody who's not you store 13 terabytes of data for you, there's no way around that being expensive or a hassle or both. Like, there's no magic solution that's going to be like, I have a way for you to do that for 3 cents or $5 a month. It's not going to happen. Like, you're already doing that.
I have a way to do it.
You're taking advantage of it the best you can with the crash plan thing. Or if you did, like, iSCSI with the Backblaze, you know, that is the cheapest way to do it. But both of those things are sort of not using the services for their intended purposes and really pushing the limits.
Yeah, I hear you.
There's a simpler solution.
Yeah, I do want to, I very much want to hear Marco's answer, but just to address a couple of things you said, your point is overall very fair, but the thing I just really, I really don't want to lose any of this media. And I think the reason I'm harping on this so much is because for the stuff that's on the Synology, that is the only place it well, with the exception of pictures, that is the only place it exists. So like all of my TV shows and movies and things like that, well, some of them actually I do have Blu-ray sitting downstairs, but for the purposes of this discussion, that's the only place it exists. It's there in Crash Plan. And so I'm so scared that if this Synology just fries and I can't salvage the drives for some crazy reason, that all of that media just goes up in a puff of smoke. Again, the pictures are different. But
the other good thing about the media stuff is it's basically immutable. Like the media files themselves, once they're there, don't change. Right. So you right. can, if you want to pinch more pennies, I know Marco was making groaning noises about Glacier, but there are various... there are various temperature storage options in S3 that can let you hold a bunch of data that you don't need access to and that's not going to change for less money than B2, maybe. I mean, you have to look at the pricing. Glacier is a pain in the butt because to get anything out of it is like pulling teeth. And maybe that's acceptable if you really just like, you know, again, if it's a super duper emergency backup type thing. But that's, you know, paring down the data you're backing up is one way, and then using slower storage with the knowledge that you don't need to access that. It's like write once and read never, right?
Yeah.
And that it doesn't change. Now, the difficulty is trying to use backup software. A lot of backup software doesn't expect that scenario. It expects to be able to sort of crawl your data and then confirm that it's backed up and diff the two things. And doing that with Glacier is going to be unfriendly probably because it doesn't expect that type of thing. But we know that the nature of your backup is I'm going to back up these terabytes of data and they're never going to change in the backup. They're just going to sit there unmodified mm-hmm. for years and yeah. years, never being updated. And so those can be fairly distant, you know, access time wise. You just need a piece of software that understands that. But this is all like all ways to pinch pennies. Can I get my bill down to 50%? Like that's the best case scenario and you're still paying $30 a month. So.
Yeah, I agree. And I promise, Marco, I'm going to give you a chance. I promise. But the other thing that occurred to me as I was talking to you guys is one of the backup strategies that I have is that a super duper clone of the iMac on a physical hard drive, one of the portable USB drives, and a physical clone of my entire photo library on a separate physical hard drive, a USB drive, that gets handed, because I see my parents at least once a month, usually twice a month, that gets handed to mom and dad at sometime after the beginning of the month, and then they bring it back right around the end of the month. I'll update both.
But why do they need to bring it back? All you're ever doing is adding to it. You know what I'm saying? Like you need to implement your own system of write-only media where you write a bunch of stuff to it and then it gets stored. And then, you know, anyway, Marco's solution is going to be to get a 14 terabyte hard drive. But anyway.
Well, and that's exactly what I'm driving. That's exactly what I was going to say is that it occurred to me as I'm talking to you guys that I'm filling my Synology. So, well, let me back up a half step. Several of the drives in my Synology, which are Western Digital, whatever the NAS Reds, I think Western Digital Reds, which are whatever it came with literally 6 years ago, almost seven, about half of the drives in there are the six-ish year old drives. And I have been replacing them bit by bit, but it occurred to me that, you know, I am really playing with fire having, I think I have 3 6-year old drives in there right now. And I really, really should try to get those, replace sooner rather than later. And as I'm replacing them, you know, I'm putting more pressure on every drive that remains. And so I'm really, really, really playing with fire. But it occurred to me as I'm replacing them, I'm swapping from 3 terabyte to 10 terabyte. And I just told you my entire backup set is like 13 terabytes. So presumably I could get one of these humongous, what are these 2.5-inch drives? It doesn't matter. One of these humongous physical platter drives.
3.5-inch. They have 14 terabyte, 3.5-inch drives.
They have 16 terabyte drives now.
So you see where this is going is I could add that to the physical package that I'm transferring back and forth to dad, you know, and just give that to mom and dad once a month and have them bring it back. And I do a quick update and then send it back to their house. And that's honestly, that's probably going to be the best solution. All right. So Marco, with all this in mind, tell me what I need to be doing because I have not hit the right answer apparently.
Okay. So this all goes back to the problem you have is that CrashPlan is the only online backup service that will back up unlimited space, including network shares, for a low price.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And most of your data lives on a Synology. So the only computer that you have where that data is local, on local disks, is the Synology. I get around this with my stupid iSCSI setup, which I would not recommend to anybody. And as soon as any part of it breaks, I'm not replacing it. But
right.
the real solution here is to take advantage of the other backup service that has way better software, is a frequent sponsor of our show, and that will back up any drive connected to your computer locally, which is Backblaze. And the way you switch to Backblaze is by making this data local to a computer that runs an OS that Backblaze clients will run on. You already have one. We already mentioned it. It's the Mac Mini that you just turned on. So the way to fix this problem, the simplest way possible, is to buy a giant hard drive. Yes, they come up to 16 terabytes now.
Oh,
buy a giant hard drive or two. Connect them as local disks to the Mac Mini. Have the Mac Mini share them on the network itself if it wants to. And have Backblaze back them up. And then you don't have to do this craziness with your parents. You have online backup. You can even put two of them in RAID 0. You have online backup, and drives last pretty long these days. Like, you could literally just do two external drives or one giant external drive, plug it into your Mac Mini, and have Backblaze back it up for the $5 or $6 a month that it is. That's it. And it's the very same. And you know what? And I know that you no longer drive a white BMW.
Oh, you don't know.
And I know that your identity is being challenged here. I'm not going to tell you to give up Plex. I'm not going to tell you to cut back your library. But I will tell you, retire the Synology at this point. Because it is old. It is not providing you the computing power that you want for things like Plex. Because, you know, it's old hardware. And it was made like right before they did a whole bunch of this transcoding acceleration stuff. You know, it's old. It's full of, by today's standards, small hard drives. It's probably costing you a decent amount in just electricity every month. So, like, just plug in an external hard drive to the Mac Mini, because you have 6 wonderful years of incredible hard drive capacity expansion that you can take advantage of now. Like, the technology has gotten better for spinning disks. They're way bigger now, and they're, you know, not that much money for very giant ones. So just do that. And it's like, I think that right there is your solution. Just switch to a local disk connected to that Mac Mini. Make that Mac Mini run all the software that your Synology was previously running. Like, just, you know, use the Mac clients of these things. Use Mac Plex. Use, you know, the Mac sharing stuff, whatever it is. Like, you know, you might give up a few things that your Synology was doing that were kind of cool that, you know, you occasionally used. But overall, I think this is a better solution, and it is way simpler. And while it requires a bit of investment up front, first of all, it's way cheaper than if you wanted to replace your Synology. It's way cheaper to replace a bunch of the drives in your Synology. And it's probably cheaper to operate, you know, with electricity and stuff. And it's definitely way better on the backup front, because then you can simply use any Mac backup software. So you can use Backblaze for their flat fee. You can do what I do and use Arc, which is fantastic. And I use Arc backing up to Backblaze B2 storage. I just kind of prefer the Arc UI for certain things. But like, you have so many more options then, because you're running what appears to backup software to be a regular consumer operating system on a regular PC/Mac, you know. But then you have options then. And you have this one great option, which is Backblaze Unlimited. And that, I think, solves your problem in a pretty simple, elegant way, and you can retire Synology.
I do wonder how long Backblaze is going to allow these type of things to go on. I saw recently a tweet where Backblaze was sad that someone was using their service to back up many large numbers of terabytes directly connected to their computer. I don't know if they're using the iSCSI trick that you're using, but similarly, like, it's meant to be a single computer thing. If you're backing up 13 terabytes... I know hard drive sizes are increasing, but still, it's kind of like an outlier. So Casey may be ruining it for everybody if someday Backblaze says, you know what, it used to be unlimited, but a few people have been abusing that privilege. So now there's a cap at 10 terabytes.
Even then, like what's great about the solution is that right now you can do it right now. It's very simple. And simple in this case is, you know, is a big benefit here, like making this not a convoluted, complicated, fragile setup. Like, just make it a very simple thing, and you right now it works. Like, in the future, who knows, but right now it will work. And in the future, if you have to spend a bit more on backing up all your media files, oh well. Like, you can kind of do the exercise of like, all right, so of all those 8 terabytes of probably movies and TV shows mostly, right? So like, of all that, what percentage of that can you just re-rip if you lose it all? And then whatever percentage of it that, you know, fell off trucks or was not available in the US or what, you know, whatever the case may be, like, how hard would it be to either re-download it from somewhere or buy it all legally? Like, and what would that cost versus what it will cost if you have to pay somebody per gigabyte to back this up for, you know, indefinitely? Like, what are you paying over time for that if you have to pay one of those $70 a month, you know, fees? What is that costing you over time versus what would it cost to actually just replace all this if you lost it? So do that math if that comes up. But honestly, you can avoid all that entirely right now by just plugging in a giant hard drive to your Mac Mini using Backblaze.
Yeah, I am not in a position that I am willing to give up my beloved Synology. And I agree with everything you said on paper, but it also does some things that I know I could do on my Mac Mini, but I like the way the Synology works. I have a very good workflow for it. I don't want to mess with that. But I take your point, and I agree with you, that getting one of these like $400 or $500 16 terabyte drives and just physically hooking it up to the Mac Mini, even if I just run like an rsync or equivalent and pull everything off of the Synology onto that drive, and then Backblaze is now backing that up as a regular old computer, that is far and away a much better answer than anything else I've come up with so far. So I already like where this is going.
Why are you pulling it off the Synology? Why don't you just leave it on, put it on the hard drive as your primary location?
Oh yeah, or you can do things like move the 8 terabytes of Plex data to the Mac Mini, you know, giant hard drive option, and leave other stuff on the Synology, which would be way smaller.
Stuff that you might care about data redundancy, so you can redo your RAID scheme to add more redundancy on the Synology and put your photos on there, so you have protection against double drive failures or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I hear you. I think what I'm looking for now is the least disruptive way to improve my world. And I think, Marco, you hit it, that just getting a big friggin' drive, at least for now, anyway.
Yeah, because they're really big these days.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't know that would work forever, but certainly for now. I mean, if I got a 16 terabyte drive, I am well over, I have at least 3 terabytes of headroom. And so as much as I am slowly filling up this Synology over time, first of all, there's certainly stuff I can get rid of in cull, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. And secondly, you know, that's plenty of extra space or plenty of headroom that I wouldn't have to worry about it anytime soon. And presumably there's no reason I couldn't just attach another one if necessary.
Right. That's so, like, once you get into this habit, like, you know, if you get like a fancy external drive enclosure that has like built-in RAID or like, you know, these giant metal boxes with, you know, multiple connectors, those get expensive.
Or a power supply that doesn't fail.
Yeah, but like, you know, single drive enclosures are basically free. Like, they're really cheap. And
they're really cheap, but they're also kind of garbagey.
All right. Well, anyway, like, if you want, you can invest in a nice big one. But, like, you know, if you keep it relatively simple, you can say, you can buy a, you know, 12 or 16 terabyte drive and say, this is the most I'm going to keep. And when you need space on it, you force yourself to go delete something that you're not going to need anymore. You know, that's another option. That's honestly not a bad solution, because you probably don't need to keep more than 16 terabytes of various media sure. files that are, you know, mostly like movies and TV shows. Like, you probably can get rid of a lot of that. So, you know, maybe capping it at a certain size that is one drive, which keeps everything a lot simpler. Maybe that's all for the best.
Yeah, I was talking about potentially abusing Backblaze by backing up so much, but it occurs to me that when my additional hard drive arrives, I'll have 16 terabytes inside my Mac Pro. So they can't really complain I'm abusing it by, you're supposed to just back up one system. It is one system. These are all inside the computer, and I can fit 8 more drives in there. So watch out, Backblaze.
To get ahead of the email that we will receive and to answer Jay Stratch in the chat, just off the top of my head, things that I want to keep on my Synology. I absolutely acknowledge and believe that a lot of this, if not all of it, could be done on the Mac Mini. I am not debating that. I like it on the Synology. I want to keep it on the Synology. It makes me happy being on the Synology. And I wrote a post about this. I'll link in the show notes that talks about a lot of this stuff. But things like VPN server, the Docker container for Homebridge, obviously I can do that on the Mac Mini. I like it on the Synology. I like it over there, off by its lonesome. What are some of the downloading, you know, torrents, if I ever do that, or stuff from newsgroups, if I were to ever do that, which obviously I wouldn't.
No.
Your Dropbox replacement thingy.
My Dropbox replacement is the biggest one of all, because for those who haven't been keeping up, I am almost entirely off of Dropbox and I use Synology Drive as a replacement. I'm sure there's something I could put on the Mac Mini that would be an equivalent, but again, I'm not looking to disrupt my entire world. I am looking to disrupt my backup strategy. And I think, Marco, if it's that I just sneaker net a 16 terabyte hard drive to my dad. If it's that,
I'm saying
put
even
it on
stop
the Mac Mini.
That. Use online
no, I agree,
backup.
I agree.
That's what it's
no, no,
for.
I agree. I'm just saying that even if I did that, which I agree with you is not the best answer, my point is that that's still a much better answer than paying, $500 a year to Backblaze B2, or at least it's a better answer for me. But I couldn't agree more that I think the bestest answer is to just stick a big fat hard drive on the Mac Mini. And I just kind of like having the Synology being the one source of truth for my data. That just makes me happy that I know it's all right there. It makes me happy in no small reason, because if, God forbid, the house went on fire, I would know, just grab the Synology after the kids. Grab the Synology, and it has all the stuff I need, which is silly, I know.
You know it's a lot smaller? A single hard drive.
That's true. That's true.
The Synology is like a mid-tower computer full of hard drives. It's heavy and huge.
I understand. No, I'm with you. But my point is just that I like having the Synology be the center of my storage world. It makes me happy. It doesn't have to make sense to you, the listener, or you, Marco Arment. But it makes me happy. And that's the way I would like to keep it. But be it a sneaker net, be it just connecting it to the Mac Mini, which again, I think is the bestest answer. One way or another, just putting a big fat hard drive somewhere and duplicating all my data on it. And that's the difference between what I'm saying, what you're saying. I would want that to be a redundant copy of all this data. You're saying just make it the canonical data. And
yeah,
again,
make it the primary
storage.
You're
probably right. Yeah, you're probably right. And on paper, I think you are right. And if I was a sane individual, I would do what you're saying. But because I'm just weird like this, I think I would have that as a redundant copy. And then, if that gets sent up to the cloud, that's the best of all answers. If for some reason I don't do that or that doesn't work, which I don't know why it wouldn't, then I could sneaker net it to dad. And it's still an improvement over the world I have today where I'm relying on CrashPlan, which I friggin' hate. So I am glad. I hope this isn't a waste of time for everyone else listening, but I'm glad we talked about it, because this is a much better plan of action than I had before. And just to reiterate, if I were to replace the Synology, I would want to take the one I have and stick it at dad's. And so I can't take the drives out of this one and put it in the new one, because I would want a redundant Synology. And to do that the way I would want to, which again, this is all my own choices, is over $3,000. That is a lot more money than a $500 16 terabyte hard drive. So I think, Marco, you hit the nail on the head.
Over time, the threshold for do you need a giant NAS box goes up with how high your storage needs are. Over time, that threshold goes up because hard drives get bigger. And you would never recommend in 2020 that somebody who needs to store 4 terabytes of data get a NAS, because hard drives or SSDs can store that locally really easily. And so if it's just going to be a few terabytes, there's no need to have a giant drive enclosure and a whole second thing to maintain and update and everything else. And I think for you, when you first got the Synology, you were within the range of you have enough data, it's reasonable to need a big multi-drive thing. But since then, the drives have gotten so big, and the backup situation has become more important, as a few things have changed about it. And so now I think you're at the point now where if you were starting from scratch today, we would never say you should get a NAS. Because while there are people who still need NAS boxes because they have massive storage needs, your storage needs no longer qualify. You are no longer one of those people. And this is why I don't think almost anybody should get a NAS. I think the time for them is mostly behind us, and most people don't need them.
Yeah.
And I think the number of people who need them is going down over time.
I think 13 terabytes is still close to that territory. For Casey, I don't know, because he has this incredible tolerance for terrible noise very close to him. But for me, the biggest advantage to the NAS is it's in the basement. I don't hear it. And if I had 13 terabytes of media, I was just talking about keeping my hard drive spun down inside my Big Mac Pro, I can have 16 terabytes of storage in there, but the storage that is not on an SSD, I do not want spinning. I want them not spinning and unmounted. And you can't do that if you actually need that data. If my photo collection was on spinning media, it would not be tenable. I don't have to mount it every time I launch photos. My photos are on my SSDs. So I don't have to deal with that. But if you have 13 terabytes of data that you need online all the time, you better be ready to deal with the sound of spinning disks fairly close to you, or you get a NAS.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I love my Synology so darn much. I love it. It's the sort of thing I would have never spent the money on at the time. And now that it's part of my world, I cannot, today anyway, I can't get rid of it. And I'm not arguing with you, Marco. You're so right in so many ways, but it has become the center of my computing world, and I like it there because it makes me happy. It has not, knock on glass, it has never failed me. It has always worked. It has never caused me problems. It's done better than my iMac Pro has, and I've had the Synology for 6 years. I've had the iMac Pro for 6 weeks. But nevertheless, your point is, again, is certainly very fair, if not correct, that for a normal person, this is not necessary. But it's... there are many like it, but this one is mine. That's a reference, John.
And if you want to throw money at the problem and you have a Mac Pro, you can get one of those cards that you can put four terabyte SSDs on, or 4 2-terabyte SSDs, and you can get two of those cards. Like, you can have 16 terabytes of internal solid state storage. So then you solve the noise problem and the access problem and the storage space problem, and it only costs you probably, what, 20, 30, 40 grand?
And the Backblaze will back it up.
Yeah. You say, look, it's one computer.
Yeah, you spend 40 grand once and you can save $70 a month. We are sponsored this week by Away. Everyone likes to travel differently, so Away offers a range of suitcases made of different materials like polycarbonate, aluminum, and durable nylon in a variety of colors and sizes. So whoever you are and whatever you need to pack, Away has great luggage that'll help make your next trip more seamless. All of Away's suitcases are designed to last a lifetime, with durable exteriors that can withstand even the roughest of baggage handlers. They also have great interior organization. This includes a built-in compression system to help you pack more, and a hidden and removable laundry bag so you can keep your dirty clothes separate from your clean clothes as you travel. They also have 4 360-degree spinner wheels, so you can maneuver it very easily throughout airports super smoothly, no matter what you need to do. And they have a TSA-approved combination lock to keep your belongings safe. And these products are designed to last a lifetime, so they back it up with a lifetime guarantee. If any part of your suitcase breaks, Away's standout customer service team will arrange to have it fixed or replaced. And you don't have to just take their word for it and take a risk on buying it. There's a 100-day trial on everything Away makes. And they actually want you to travel with it, because how else would you test it, right? So take the product out on the road. Live with it. Travel with it. Get lost with it. Whatever you want to do for 100 days. And after that time, if you decide it's not for you, you can return any non-personalized item for a full refund during that period. No ifs, ands, or asterisks. And they have free shipping and free returns on any order within the contiguous U.S., Europe, Canada, and Australia. So start your risk-free 100-day trial and shop the entire Away lineup of travel essentials, including their best-selling suitcases, at awaytravel.com/accidentaltech. That's awaytravel.com/accidentaltech. Thank you so much to Away for sponsoring our show.
As we record this, it is the evening of March 4th, and WWDC is still a thing. In theory.
Well, it hasn't been announced yet.
All right, WWDC is never a thing until it is announced. Previous WWDC was announced, we attended, and then it ended. And at that point, WWDC ceases to exist until there is a future announcement that says, hey, guess what? We're doing WWDC, and here are the dates. So right now, we're in the in-between time when WWDC does not exist. It only exists as a thing that happened in the past.
It's like doing a show with two lawyers, I tell you what.
Everyone loves lawyers.
You're right. You are right.
I'm just saying, like, it's just the unknown. Like, what I'm saying is that the current period we're in is not that dissimilar from years past, where we are waiting to find out when WWDC will be. The difference this year is one of the prominent options is not this year.
Yep. And so the reason this is, potentially going to be a thing is because of the coronavirus, or whatever the correct term for it is. Yeah.
COVID-19.
Thank you. It is certainly going around the world. It's going around the U.S. now. It sounds like Seattle in particular, a lot of things are happening out there, and that's a lot closer to California than, say, Marco and John and I are. A lot of other conferences have also said they're canceling. The Geneva Auto Show got canceled. Google I.O. got canceled. That usually happens about a month before DubDub. There's a lot of smoke saying that WWDC is probably going to be canceled. And I noticed, but have not yet had a chance to listen, that on Under the Radar, you and in front of the show, David Smith, covered this and kind of alternatives. And so I don't know if you want to rehash briefly some of that, but I guess let me start by asking, starting with Marco, do you suspect that WWDC will happen in person this year? And let's leave aside like a press event. I'm talking about like the regular people, you know, the thing that we're allowed to go to, the regular people, you know, Worldwide Developer Conference. Do you suspect that that will happen in person in California this year, Marco?
Almost certainly not. I am like 90% sure it's going to be canceled. They just haven't announced it yet. Like I tweeted this to the effect of the day. Like my theory is basically that I'm pretty sure they've already made the decision internally to cancel it, and they're just trying to make alternative arrangements for things like, you know, online sessions and whatever else, so that they can announce at the same time. Like, instead of just saying no WWDC this year, I'm guessing they want to do an announcement that says, you know, WWDC will be online only this year, and here's all the great things we're going to have to offer. Like something, you know, a little more upbeat. That I think is much more likely to happen. And yeah, and I did talk about this for, you know, the entire Under the Radar episode with our friend underscore David Smith. So check out Under the Radar from today. I'll link to it in the show notes. That is, you know, certainly worth listening to if you want to hear us talk for almost exactly 30 minutes about this exact topic and kind of the, you know, what it means and kind of, you know, what Apple could do instead. And we're going to recover some of that here, of course, but certainly check that out if you are interested in this topic. But yeah, I think there's the chances of Apple holding this conference are extremely low because, you know, this is a significant virus that's going around the world. It is, you know, it is causing deaths, and it's not like, you know, it's not killing everybody who gets it, but it is a serious problem, and it's not something that can be taken lightly. It's something that everybody needs to be very cautious about. And Apple is a cautious company, and Apple is a company that tries to avoid bad press whenever possible. And no company wants to put on an event that, you know, at the event exposes people to this virus and one of them dies. Like, that's horrible. Nobody wants to risk that, understandably. And so there is no way that I think Apple's going to put this conference on. I think they are way too smart to do that. And anybody who's running a big event right now for a high profile thing, like, if they're not canceling that event, they're not thinking right. Because, you know, it's a big enough problem. Like the virus is a pretty big problem. The effects are still largely unknown. The gestation period is long, and so you don't really realize how bad it is for a couple of weeks after it has gotten that bad. And these are all events that have to be planned months ahead of time that are, you know, that are gathering a whole bunch of people from all over the world in like, you know, confined spaces. And it's just ludicrous to think that any of these major events are going to happen, or at least that they should happen. You know, there are some conferences that are happening in the near future that are still going to go on allegedly, but I think that's a mistake for those conferences, and I think they're hearing from it. Like, you know, major sponsors and participants are pulling out of these conferences. Companies are restricting their employees' travel. They're saying like they're not allowing their employees to travel to conferences anymore for a lot of things like this. Like it's a big deal. And Apple's not going to take any risks. Apple's not stupid. They're a conservative, smart company. There's no way this conference goes on.
John, what do you think?
I was thinking about, you know, I haven't heard the Under the Radar, but like various options you can do. You know, WWDC has been streaming live online for the past couple of years. Not only do you get the sessions, but you can like watch them at the same time as the people in the room, maybe with a 7-second delay or something. And then they have the recordings of the video and, you know, all sorts of things that they could do over the internet. And of course, obviously the press only keynote that you could do the same way they do all the other press only keynotes. But the thing occurred to me is, It's a very Apple move to also find some way to charge quote unquote attendees $1,600 to attend it online. But I'm like, what would be the distinction between the people who pay $1,600 and the people who don't? Because already, if you pay nothing, you can stream the sessions live for free. What would you be getting? Would they mail you a jacket and some pins? they mail you some terrible box lunches.
Yeah, I don't think the ticket price comes close to paying for like the massive cost that Apple endures for this conference. Like, you know, when you combine all the various factors, you know, the ticket price probably pays for the venue and your box lunches.
Well, if they add in our hotel fees, it pays for everything, but Apple doesn't get the hotel money.
Yeah, and it probably doesn't, like, I'm sure to Apple, from their point of view, the most expensive part of this conference every year is probably the massive amount of time it takes to prepare for all the employees, all the engineers that have to go there and prepare presentations and be there for the labs. And like, that's a massive amount of labor that goes into that. That is probably way more expensive to Apple than the actual nuts and bolts of, like, the conference center costs this much, the lunches cost this much. Like, I don't, and that's why, like, assuming they don't hold this conference, I think what they are most likely to do is to just do a bunch of online sessions, just like they've been doing. As you said, like, they've been live streaming. I think they're just going to release a bunch of session videos and have a small media event where they live stream a keynote. And I think that's going to be it. Now, I would like to see them do more. This is what we talked about on Under the Radar, this part of it. Like, I would love to see them invest more heavily in things like documentation, sample code, you know, like, and possibly, this is a bit of a reach, but possibly staff up DTS and expand some kind of form of the labs to be online and public, where you get to actually, like, talk to Apple engineers about specific questions and problems you have with specific APIs and your code, and they'll look at it and they'll, like, you know, similar to what, you know, DTS incidents do when you have a developer account, but free and easier, like that kind of thing. DTS is famously a very, 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 very small staff, and I would love to see them staff it up. I would love to see them take the resources they are saving by presumably not having this conference and use that to really beef up the documentation and really beef up the sample code and the and really, you know, beef up DTS and, like, just give more developers more access to stuff without having them fly across the world to stay in a very expensive hotel and you know, go to this one thing in person for these few days a year. Because if you think about it, like, that whole system is incredibly inefficient and incredibly exclusionary. Like, it's very exclusive. Like, the percentage of Apple developers that can actually go to the conference is such a tiny percentage of all the Apple developers out there in the world. It's this, you know, a few thousand people out of hundreds of thousands or millions of iOS developers around the world. Like, we're talking a lot of people here. It's a very big field. And so anything they can do to make that more accessible to more people has way more value than anything they could possibly change about the conference itself, like, of, you know, how it is for local attendees. And, you know, I like the conference. I've been fortunate enough to be able to go to every one of them since 2009. And I consider that a privilege. And yet, I also look at it as, you know, every year I kind of think, wow, this is kind of wasteful. This is very expensive. That's one of the reasons why I stopped getting badges a couple years ago too, is like, you know, because I'm going mostly for, like, the community events and occasional, like, find a way to sneak into a lab and ask, like, one question to a lab person. But otherwise, like, I'm mostly going for the community events and everything. But like, they would have so much more value to more people if they beefed up all of the online resources. And if they're not going to have a conference this year, I think that is a good, like, if you can find a silver lining in them canceling this conference, that's it. Like, they should redirect that energy and that time to making things that everybody can use, making all that stuff better. The documentation's in a terrible state. Sample code has been decimated by all the changes in Swift. Like, most sample code doesn't work anymore. Like, it's just, they really need a lot of help in documentation and all that supporting stuff. And it needs help. And I hope it gets it. That being said, I don't think most of that is likely to happen. I think what's most likely to happen is the conference gets canceled and we just get videos and a keynote from, you know, a media event, and that's it, and no other changes. That's much more likely, I think.
Well, about the videos, though, you mentioned, like, the cost of putting on WWDC. The cost to the engineering org is the engineers' time that they take out to prepare and perform the presentations, and that time doesn't probably shrink at all for them doing it, you know, on a stage versus not. if anything, maybe they have to do more takes in front of a camera, right? Because they still have to prepare the presentations. They still have to make sure they have slides and sample code and a rehearsed presentation that it has correct, you know, all the art on it is correct and all the information is correct and it matches up with the WWDC build. And like that engineering time is absorbed whether we're there or not. All the people whose time gets back are the people who plan the event, deal with the venue, deal with meals, deal with security. Those people don't have to do anything. Like, they're freed up, but they're not going to suddenly hop on to making the documentation better, right? So it is still a fairly large cost to Apple's engineering org. The part they save for the engineers is you don't have to be in this building for a couple of days or the entire week. You know, you don't have to actually physically be there. Once you're done with your video, you can resume your regular work, and then the videos go out to the world, right? And then as for like labs and remote labs, I think it was making me, when you were saying that, it was making me think about, do you remember when iChat video conferencing first came out? One of the features it had is you could sort of share a document. Like, you could see the little faces on these screens in this little 3D kind of view. And then you could also share a document and then your two little faces would be looking at the document. Do you remember that?
No.
So they had multi-person conferencing, right? And the way they did it was instead of in the window, just seeing like the other person, right? You would see the other person would become like a little tile that would sort of move back into the screen, kind of like a bunch of picture frames sitting on a table or whatever. And then when you shared a document, that document would be another little picture in the sort of setting, like a cover flow type setting. Anyway, the point is it would let two people, you know, it would let you see the other person's face and a document that they can also see on their screen. And I can't tell you how many times I'm usually doing stuff with my parents on FaceTime or whatever, and we essentially want to share a document. Let's all look at the whatever thing together, like in this context, not, hey, I'm going to open up another window and I'm going to look at this document and you look at it too. And like, so we could both be looking at it together. And I know with like Google Docs or whatever, you can interactively see each other's cursors and both be looking at the same document or whatever, but it's so much easier if you can just say, here, in this multi-person FaceTime chat with the whole family, let's look at this thing, or let's look at a bunch of pictures together. I have a slideshow to show you. Let's go through it. Oh, look at all the pictures, and you can see the pictures and the people's reaction to them. Something like that would go a long way towards making things like labs possible, right? Interactively over some Apple product or communication protocol that Apple feels is secure and you're all happy with or whatever, let's all be sort of collaboratively working on a thing. Something better than, oh, I'm going to let Apple control my screen with screen sharing, or I'm going to let Apple view my whole desktop with screen sharing, just to selectively share documents or a single window, or to be, you know, tools that Apple's generally not good at. As a company that tends to frown upon people telecommuting, they like things to be in person, and they don't have a lot of collaborative tools to be able to have a bunch of people working on something together. As terrible as things like WebEx and Zoom and Microsoft Teams and Slack and all these other things are, almost all of those tools have as table stakes a bunch of people can communicate through audio and video and also can all be looking at a single document or a screen at the same time. And if you're going to do anything remotely like labs, when people aren't in person, you need something like that. And Apple has nothing like that. I can't really imagine Apple instructing everyone to download Zoom or WebEx. So remote labs, unless it's all going to be over like, do what I do with my parents, which is we're all on FaceTime, and then I like hold up like a phone or a laptop screen in front of the camera so they can see. It's just, I don't see that working. Whereas in the labs, you're both hunched over the same laptop and everything works out. So, yeah, I'm not optimistic about that. But getting back to my earlier point about cost of money, I'm also not optimistic about the idea that once there's no longer a conference, suddenly engineers will have a bunch of time to sharp their docs. Now, it could be that one of the announcements at WWDC is, since last WWDC, we've had a concerted effort to improve our documentation, and it's all rolling out this week. And that's like revealing work that they had done over 6 months or a year. That, if that's what they had done, that happens whether or not they have WWDC. It doesn't have nothing to do with freeing up engineers' time. It has to do with the thing they already did in the past. And I'm hoping that's the case. I'm hoping the reveal is, we made a big effort to improve this aspects of the developer experience, and we are revealing it at WWDC, not doing it while you're watching a bunch of pre-recorded videos.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold my breath on that.
Nope.
Never know. I mean, even if they don't really do it, they tend to make announcements like that. If they know it's a thing that people want, they'll want to have an announcement that says, we've heard your complaints about documentation and we've improved documentation in X, Y, and Z way. Whether or not is it a significant improvement or they, you know, make it sound better than it is, very often there's some effort to help with that. You know, even if they don't come out and say it, they'll just say, here's a new framework and we're really proud of the documentation. There's lots of different ways they could spin it to try to sort of address the issue in some way. And I think that might happen. I don't know. It's so hard to predict WWDC because very often there's something big and shiny that they can throw out and will just distract everybody from any issues, any boring issues like documentation and sample code. Like, say, an ARM transition.
Oy. Can you imagine if this was the year for the ARM transition? That would be brutal. I don't know. I just want to reiterate, though, what Marco had said earlier on, that, you know, for the three of us, you know, this is our job. Well, I think especially for me and Marco, maybe for John, it's our job to go to the conference, or at least to go to the event, I should say, and be there for it and make an appearance. And, you know, I think to some degree it is kind of a responsibility for the three of us to have a live show there when it happens. But it is extremely expensive. Not only is the ticket $1,600, but any even slightly reasonable hotel is easily another $1,600, if not $2,000+. And I will never forget, I don't remember who said it to me, but I will never forget when it started to get really and truly expensive when it was still in San Francisco proper. Somebody looked at me, and I think it was the year that the Apple Watch had just been released or announced or whatever.
I believe this was Underscore who said it.
Was it Underscore?
I think so.
Surprise me. Underscore looked at me and said, you realize that this $400 a night hotel is you buying an Apple Watch every single night and then throwing it away. And my mind exploded. And I just couldn't believe it. And I was like, Oh, God, you're right. Oh, that's not good at all. I mean, that is preposterous. That is utterly preposterous. I mean, I could go on a 3-hour tear about how obnoxiously expensive everything in the Valley is, and I don't understand how anyone can afford to live there. But be that as it may, to go to this conference, as someone who lives in the United States, you're probably going to need to get on a plane. So that's between $500 and $1,000 in most cases. If you want a ticket to the event, that's $1,600. So call that an even $2,000. Then you want to sleep somewhere, and preferably somewhere that like has, you know, all the walls, this floor and the ceiling. So that's probably another $2,000. So you're looking at $4,000. You haven't eaten anything. You haven't drank anything. And I'm not even talking booze, just in general. You haven't eaten or drank anything. You do get those sweet, sweet, sweet box lunches for quote unquote free, but you haven't had breakfast. Oh, I guess you could have their crap circular bagel-like things at the conference, but you certainly haven't had dinner. I mean, you're looking at between $4,000 and $5,000 for a week, and it's just insane. It's just bananas that it's that expensive. And, you know, somebody in the chat is saying, well, that's just what hotels cost. Absolutely not. It is like $100 a night to get a really decent room where I am.
Yeah. And these aren't nice hotels. They're like really mediocre hotels that if they were anywhere else in the country, would be like $150 a night. And instead they're $400.
or more.
Yeah, right.
Or more. It's preposterous. And so, as we have said, you know, I love WWDC. I really do. I love the event.
Yeah, me too.
The conference. I love the actual conference that takes place in the convention center. I love, 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 love all the superfluous and other things that happen around it. When I had the chance to go to Layers, I loved that. There's so much good to be said about this, but I also feel like there's been some tension building over the last several years as things are just getting insurmountably expensive, and to the point that the only people who can afford it are people who are billing their employer. And maybe that's okay with Apple. I don't know. But for someone like the three of us, it's tough. It's hard. It's frustrating. And so I would love to see it, as much as I would hate to see it go away on a more permanent basis, although it seems like we all agree that maybe this year we should sit this one out. As much as I would hate to see it go away on a permanent basis, I would love to see a lot of things change. And I'm really looking forward to listening to that Under the Radar to hear what you and David had to say about it.
And I would even go a little bit further. I would push a little harder on the angle of, like, you know, making that this is kind of, you know, ridiculous now. If you look at the landscape of tech conferences as a whole, there was a period, kind of a golden era of tech conferences that were mostly smaller conferences. Started about 10 years ago and ran until probably about 3-4 years ago. And this was an era when there were lots of conferences, big and small, at all different price points, all around the world, and they were due pretty well. Like, you know, it was always a lot of work to put them on. A few of our friends put them on. And, you know, it's kind of like throwing a wedding, but every year. And so it was certainly, you know, work. But, like, it was a fun little community. It was a fun, you know, thing to do for the group of people who was lucky enough to be able to do it, basically, and travel all over the world and go to these fun things, or hope that one was came up near you and it made things a lot more accessible to more, you know, localities. But something changed a few years ago, and it started to become increasingly difficult to sell conference tickets. It started to become increasingly difficult to run a conference and break even and not just lose all your money and you know, not to mention all the work you put into it. Like, running conferences is a terrible way to make money. It's even worse than writing books. It became, like, kind of the market for conferences seemed to really crumble apart a few years ago. And most of the conferences that were going strong 5 years ago are gone now. And there are very few that seem to be left. And I wonder, my theory at the time, for the most part, has been, like, it used to be that you could get somebody like John Gruber to speak at a conference, and that would sell tickets. That you could go, and if you wanted to hear John Gruber talk about something, you could go to the conference, pay whatever the ticket fee is, and travel there, and you could see people that you liked online. You could see them talk, and it was interesting, and you could, like, meet them afterwards, maybe, or hang out, or have this little community of other people who were there, hang out with them. And that was great for a while. And then everybody got a podcast, or everybody got it. And then everybody got a YouTube channel. And now you can hear the people who you're interested in. You can hear their thoughts for free all the time in podcasts or on YouTube channels. And you no longer need to go to conferences to, you know, hear what these people sound like in real life, or to see, like, what, you know, to kind of get an idea of their personality beyond, like, just their words that they write on a site somewhere. You can actually just listen to their podcast or watch a YouTube channel for free, and everybody can do it. And preparing conference talks as the presenter, that format has a certain expectation of, like, formality and preparation that makes it a very time-intensive thing to make. It's preparing conference talk is a ton of work. Making good slides, rehearsing the talk, you know, giving it, like, a nice story arc and everything. It's a ton of work for the presenter. And you do all that work, and all you get out of it is, at the end, maybe 100 people or a couple hundred people see it. Maybe if you're lucky, there will be a good video and it'll live on for a while, you know, outside of the conference. But usually that didn't happen. Usually, you know, you're giving it to the room and that's it. Or you can do a podcast or a YouTube video, which is usually unscripted or less scripted. There's not the big expectation of, like, the formal, like, slides and nicely designed everything. You have the opportunity to edit if you want to. And it's just a different format. It's a much lower work to output format than a conference talk. So you have all of us, like, who used to go to conferences and speak, we now do other things because, frankly, it's less work and we reach way more people with way less effort. And so you have that side of the market. Then on the other side, you have people just not seeing the need to pay hundreds or thousands, usually, of dollars to go to conferences to see people when they can just listen to their podcasts. And so I think the market for conferences in general has mostly evaporated for that kind of, like, you know, community, small kind of thing. What's left are these, like, mega conferences that usually, like, the platform owners run for the people on their platform. So, you know, things like WWDC, Google I.O. And by the way, and I'm not talking about conventions. Like, Comic-Con, like, that's a separate thing. I'm not in that world. I don't know anything about that world. But I'm talking about, like, conferences of, like, it's, like, instructional talks to people, or, you know, here's my origin story, that kind of thing. That's mostly what I'm talking about. The market for that is really hard now. The small conferences are mostly gone. You're mostly looking at just the big platform vendors. And people go to these things, like, basically just to hear about the new APIs and go to the labs and try to get time with developers. Like, that's mostly what these big things are for now. And so the more of that I think that we can remove the need for, the better everybody will be, because the way that the smaller conference has died has resulted in way more availability of these people's wonderful content available to everyone all around the world anytime for free. So how much can we do to make WWDC and conferences like it more like that? How much can we do to reduce the need for these, to make their value available to more people all the time, everywhere, for free?
I feel like the kind of conference you're talking about definitely is undercut by podcasts, but there is another kind of conference that lives on and, in fact, has sort of blossomed in the shadow of the other kinds of conferences for good and for ill, and that's the more instructive sort of like classroom type of thing where it's like a little miniature school. So it's you can't replace it with like a one-way communication because it's interactive, like a classroom where there's a room full of students and a teacher and you're going through some curriculum and you get to ask questions and stuff, and that doesn't happen in a podcast or YouTube setting. It's educationally focused, so people and or companies are willing to pay for it as a form of training. And these ones tend to be, I mean, they're also the big ones, but the big ones tend to be less instructional. The smaller ones can get away with being more instructional. It's because we're not a platform owner. In fact, our business is teaching you how to use insert technology and or product here so that you can be trained up and get these skills to either get a job or improve at your current job. And companies will pay for you to go this type of training. There are a couple of big to medium shows in this area, like Event Apart, an Event Apart for Web Technologies, which is a longstanding conference. But even like little things where it's just, one form of it is someone will come into your company and teach a bunch of people a thing. But there are ones you go to at a particular location and to learn about stuff. There are some scammy ones that are, come to this 10-day boot camp and we'll turn you into or whatever. And you pay all this money. And it's like, I could have just learned this online. But I feel like that type of that interactive nature lends itself to an in-person room full of people. It's where the math starts to make sense of like, well, why would I spend all this time on this, polishing this message to tell it to a room of 100 people? But you wouldn't have that same question about why would a room of 50 people and one or two teachers spend their time narrowcasting to each other? It's like, well, it's interactive. It's a classroom. You don't want a million people in a classroom. A million people in a classroom can't learn that way. You need some sort of give and take, some sort of question and answer, why education tends to work that way and has not turned over entirely to just a one-way blast of a YouTube channel that teaches you math or something, although there's a place for that as well. So I think that type of conference is more durable and maybe has a better business model because you feel like you're getting value out of it. I mean, certainly the business model of people paying money for education is well established. So I'm thinking that that's going to be harder to go away. But you're right that the consolidation in the other kind of conference has not left a lot of room for the small things that you're describing. And then if you think about what's left, F8, AWS reInvent, whatever the hell that thing is called. I think they're still doing that giant Oracle thing. There's a giant Salesforce conference, WWDC. Yeah, it's all the big giant platform owners. And the networking, the sort of in-person networking is still definitely a real thing. I think that same networking happens at those educational things as well, but certainly happens much more at, let's say, the Salesforce conference or whatever. I think that is, well, I don't know. I'm saying this as someone who doesn't like to, as an introvert. You can do a surprising amount of networking online, but I think, as we all know, like it's easy to say these in-person conferences have been replaced by podcasts after we have all gone through a phase where we went to a bunch of them and met a bunch of people who are now our friends. Like that type of in-person networking is really valuable. And just because we've established a friend group in our industry already doesn't mean that now we no longer need those conferences because we don't need them. Therefore, nobody should have them. I think first time WWDC attendees come away with connections that are super important for the future of their career. And it'll be a shame, in particular in the Apple community, to lose that because just think about it. How did I meet Casey? How did I meet you in person at the WWDC? Would we ever have met if WWDC didn't exist and we weren't there in person?
No, you don't go anywhere.
Exactly. And I knew of Marco online for a long time before that, but we had never interacted until we had occasion to be in the same place at the same time. It's the way that works. So in some ways, I mean, we have the problem of scale here where it's like, well, that's great. When Apple's a smaller company, that made sense. But your point earlier, Marco, is totally true. There are so many developers that the fraction of them that gets to WWDC just keeps going down and down. And so, me saying that there should still be WWC because other people need to have the same opportunity to network that we had is true, but their opportunity is so slim because they're, you know, they have to enter a lottery to get a ticket, for crying out loud. It used to be that Apple would call you and say, hey, you know, you have a free WWC ticket that comes with your ADC Premier membership. Do you want to use that? And people would go, nah. Like Apple would nag you to try to cajole you into using your free ticket as part of your, you know, thousand something dollar ADC Premier. Times have changed. There is a lot of demand. There is very little supply. But I still think for developers, for new developers or developers new to the Apple community, that in-person contact with the group of other Apple developers is actually really valuable. And it would actually be great if they could expand that rather than contracting it. You probably talked about this on Another Radar, but the whole Tech Talks thing where Apple would come to your city with a smaller crew and do a bunch of presentations to a limited subset. Before I ever went to WWDC, I went to a Boston area Tech Talk thing and didn't meet anybody because I don't like people. But they were there. If I wanted to, I could have talked to Paul Kafasis, but I didn't.
You were near the people, at least.
Yeah, I was near them. So that type of thing where, you know, maybe in a post-coronavirus world, providing a place where people can actually meet each other physically does still serve a purpose, I think.
Well, but I do want to touch on one aspect of the whole, like, you know, networking and meeting people angle here. Like, so I spent a large part of my my coming of age years on the internet on discussion forums, you know, old like Ultimate Bulletin Board, PHP BB, like that kind of, you know, forums. And it became clear to me over time that forums have a certain ideal size. And that if you are below that size, it's just kind of too low traffic, and there's not much reason for anybody to go like check it regularly because there's not enough new stuff. And then when you're in the certain size band, it's great because you know there's good traffic, and there's, you know, you can visit the forum throughout the day and see new stuff, and people can play off each other and get responses fairly fast, and it's really nice. But if it grows too large, there's also an upper bound beyond which it's just too much. And it doesn't function very well as a community anymore. It doesn't feel very community-like. The community mechanics start to break down. It becomes like, you know, just more hectic and too much volume. And the entire forum mechanic just has this like higher, this upper bound where it just kind of falls apart and isn't very good anymore. Conferences have that too. And there, like, I actually don't think there is like a minimum size below which conferences like suck. I've been to conferences that have like 50 people, and I've been to conferences that have 5,000 people, and I wouldn't say the 50 people ones were bad. In fact, they were some of the best ones. I think the value of networking and of meeting people at a conference goes down as the number of attendees goes up, because it becomes harder for people who don't already have their friend groups to actually find and meet the people they want to meet, or to find and meet, you know, even just like-minded other people who, even if they weren't like, you know, people they knew before, like the percent, like as the number of conference attendees goes up, and especially as you don't get as many like repeat visitors every year, because, you know, the number of people trying to get in is so high that like they try to give a lot of first-time tickets, so like it's hard to get a ticket multiple years in a row. So like the odds of like building up community, you know, that actually is meaningful, and networking that's meaningful over, you know, over a year or two or whatever else, I feel like that gets harder as the conference gets bigger. And I think WWDC these last few years has crossed that threshold where it's actually pretty difficult to network with people, because it's almost like there's just too many people there. It's like a little bit too big. And I don't think the move to San Jose has actually helped that much, although I don't know if it's really hurt it, but it seems like the conference is so big now that even that aspect that's supposed to be really good about conferences is harder now. It's harder to get value out of that.
See, I disagree with you slightly. I think networking is just as good, if not better, because you're getting a new batch of people, well, you know, largely a new batch of people every year. But the thing that I struggle with, and the thing that was so great about early WWDC, so I started going in 2011. The thing that was so great about that is, you know, in 2011, I met, you know, maybe five or 10 people that I really hit it off with, John included. And then in 2012, I met another couple of people. And over the years, I've met more and more people and have made more lasting relationships. And that, I think you're absolutely right. It is harder to build a lasting and meaningful relationship across several WWDCs because, A, it's unlikely that you yourself will go to several in a row, like you said. And, B, even if you dedicate yourself to going, maybe you're going to Layers, if not the big show, or maybe you're just hanging out. Then, you know, Joe Smith or Mary Smith or whomever that you met last year, maybe they didn't make it this year. And that makes that sort of thing different. But if you just want to meet a whole bunch of people at random places, you know, in the traditional businessy way of networking, I don't think that's really any worse. But I do find for me, it's very hard to effectively and appropriately manage my time because and I don't know, maybe this is inside baseball, maybe this is first world problems, and if it's really terrible, Mark will just cut it. Hooray. But for me, it's very hard because I want to spend time with you and John, for example, and Mike, you know, my co-host across my shows. I want to spend a lot of time with you guys because I don't get to spend time with you guys in person really ever, except in June. But I also want to spend time with people that I don't see often. And so, like, on the occasions that Jelly is in town, I mean, he's coming from the future. He's coming from Australia. So it is not easy to get him and I in the same spot. And I want to spend time with Jelly. But then at the same time, I want to spend time with Apple engineers that I'm friendly with, sometimes just as friendly with, that I don't get to see very often. So I want to make time for them. And then while I'm there, I also want to make time for people I don't know, you know, and try to be available for people who are strangers to me, but maybe I've been in their ears for the last 5 years. And I want to make time for them. And so what ends up happening is, for me, I'm always saying to somebody, oh, I can meet with you for 20 minutes. Or, oh, yeah, I'd love to hang out, but I got to go. Or, oh, I didn't realize what time was. I'm sorry, we're in the middle of a very deep and important conversation. I really got to go. And that sort of thing has also become very hard. And I think a lot of that is because I've come to know a bunch of people over the years. But I don't think that's unique to being a podcaster. I think it's just unique to having gone several years in a row. And it's just, yeah, I don't know. It's all really tough, and I would like to see a change, but darned if I know what to recommend. And, you know, I don't know how to backseat drive this conference.
Well, it's part of the reason I think that Apple's kept WWDC relatively small. Like, WWDC hasn't, like, it's gotten bigger in that more people want to go, which means there's more turnover from year to year. But, like, to your earlier point, like, even if you don't see any of the same people, very often you maybe your first or your second year, you meet a particular group of people and then you kind of, that becomes your friend group after the thing. You don't need to see them again the next year at WWDC for that to stick. I mean, I think that's been true of a lot of first time or second time attendees. Certain people you meet there, you still know and are friends with. And it's not because you saw them again the second year, although maybe that helps or whatever. But for WWDC being 5,000-ish people, and by the way, when you said early WWDCs in reference 2011, I'm sure lots of people were rolling their eyes because it's another reason that WWDC is going to be a big change is Apple's been running it for a long time. This is going to be the first year they skipped since the 80s, 90s. I have a VHS tape of a WWDC upstairs. But yeah, so like it is possible to have, and most of these big conferences, platform owner conferences, 10 times as many people as WWDC. And I think if you were to ask somebody at the 60,000 person Salesforce conference, do you find it difficult to network because there are 60,000 people? I mean, granted, it's a different group of people. I think they're going to say, no, it's great. Tons of people. I mean, love meeting the people and doing all the networking and so on and so forth. Like, smaller conferences are more intimate and you're able to connect, you know, in a sort of a more reliable fashion with a smaller group of people with less effort. But I don't think 5,000 is too big. And even though the demand is so great that there's turnover, I think it's still, I mean, I think you have to look at it from the eyes of a first-time attendee, like not from a multi-year attendee who has a bunch of people they know and whose time is in such demand, like, you know, ours or Casey's or whatever. Like, it's just, if you're maybe first or second year attendee and you're just overwhelmed by the sessions and you go to labs and you meet one or two other people, doing that just once can be incredibly valuable to just sort of get you started on your career, which is why, you know, I'm not saying that I think WWDC needs to continue exactly the way it is, but I think there needs to be some kind of, it would be a shame for that to go away without any kind of replacement. And I'm not sure what could possibly replace it, but I think it's been valuable in my career in life. And I hear from people who have attended for the first or second or third time that they also find it valuable. Even for people who say, I don't go anymore, but I'm so glad I went that one or two times because it really, you know, set me on my path, right? There's, as much as I don't like going out into the world, being face-to-face with people is extremely valuable. Again, would we be doing this podcast had we not met face-to-face, despite the fact that we, you know, at least Marco knew of me and I knew of him online, but it never led us to start a podcast together, right? And nobody knew Casey, so.
Who the hell is like, that guy anyway?
I feel like meeting in person was an essential catalyst, and it's very difficult for me to say, but we don't need that anymore because it's too big and it doesn't work. Like there are limits, but I feel like WWDC is one of the things Apple has done with WWDC is tried to keep it from getting big. Because if they wanted to make WWDC a 50,000 person conference, they could probably do it, but they haven't and they don't. And 5,000 may be a little bit crowded, but I still feel like it's tenable. I see the people who are there and, you know, who are first time people hanging out, and maybe they're star off in a group with the people from their company, but then they talk to some other group. Like, I think it still works at that level.
I couldn't agree with you more. It has been such a valuable, you know, portion of my life and career that I would hate to have somebody else miss out on that, since it made such a big difference for me.
We are sponsored this week by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com/ATP. Enter offer code ATP at checkout to get 10% off. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace. Squarespace makes it super easy to make a website. And not just any website, a really professional-looking, nicely designed, highly functional website that can offer all sorts of rich functionality if you need it. So things like galleries and storefronts and podcast hosting, in addition to things like, you know, what regular sites need. Info pages, contact forms, event lists, calendars, all sorts of stuff that websites need. You can do it no matter what your skill level is at Squarespace. Everything is done with intuitive, easy-to-use tools. And this is no coding anywhere. If you need to jump into the code, there are a few places where you can, but frankly, you probably won't need to. This is no coding required. You don't need to be a developer to do this. Anybody can go on Squarespace and make a great looking site. And their sites are professionally designed. You can take their amazing templates and you can customize them to your heart's content. You can move stuff around. You can change colors, change fonts, change your logo. Whatever you need to do to make it look like your site, you can do that with Squarespace. And they even give you a free domain if you sign up for a whole year. You can see for yourself how easy Squarespace is by starting a free trial. No credit cards required. You can start a free trial. You can build a whole site and you can play with it basically as long as you want. And it's amazing what you can get done in such a short time. You can see for yourself the amazing power of this platform. If you need any help along the way, they have amazing support as well. And you don't never have to worry about things like software upgrades or patches or uptime or downtime or anything like that. They take care of all of that for you. So see for yourself at squarespace.com/ATP. When you decide to sign up after that free trial, make sure to go back there, squarespace.com/ATP. Use offer code ATP to get 10% off your first purchase. Thank you so much to Squarespace for sponsoring our show. Make your next move with a beautiful website from Squarespace.
All right, let's do some Ask ATP. And Roar Lokar writes, kind of paraphrased, "The command option click dock shortcut to open a Finder window is amazing. What are some of your favorite macOS shortcuts?" I think I have a ton, but I can only think of a handful off the top of my head. So I have three for Finder and two for Xcode. First of all, for Finder, Command-K to get to a window that'll let you open a VNC session, which has been very critical now that I'm using the Mac Mini remotely a lot, or an SMB, you know, or a network share to, say, your Synology. Shift-Command-A for applications. That is to say, to go into the applications folder. Shift-Command-4 to take a screenshot, or Shift-Command-4-space to take a screenshot of a specific window. And then for Xcode, Option-Command-/ for creating documentation. So, you know, the method summary, parameters, et cetera, et cetera. And Shift-Command-O for quick open, so to open a file very quickly by typing the file name. I really like those. I should steal one or two of Marco's that I also agree with, but I will let you actually have your own moment in the sun.
Thank you. So one of my favorites that I use all the time is paste and match style. This gets you around the problem of if you copy rich text and you're pasting it somewhere where you don't want to paste its formatting that it came with. You want it to match the formatting of what you're pasting it into, which is usually no formatting. So paste and match style does that. In my opinion, this should actually be the default behavior on both platforms. It's not. In On the Mac, you have to do the special shortcut. On iOS, there is no built-in method of pace and match style. I actually, on iOS, I use an app called, I believe, Copy Plain Text, and it simply offers a share extension that copies what you have selected only as plain text. So that way you can go paste it effectively unformatted. It's the app is simply called Plain Text. I'm sure that'll be easy to find. I'll link to it in the show notes. So on iOS you gotta do some crazy thing. On the Mac, the way to do paste and match style, it's a menu item. You can see it under the edit menu if you don't want to remember this. But you basically hold down Command Option Shift V. Yeah, so Command V is paste, and then Command Option Shift V is paste and match style. I love one of the things I turn on every Mac I use is if you go into the accessibility preference pane, you go to Zoom, and you check the box that says use scroll gesture with modifier keys to zoom, and I use the control key. What this allows me to do is hold down the control key and do either a mouse wheel scroll or whatever the scroll gesture is on your mouse or trackpad, and that allows you to zoom in and see the entire screen zoom in and out simply by holding down control and scrolling. And this can be very useful to simply very quickly make something big, or to check, like if you're a developer working or a designer working on pixel stuff, you can like check like alignment a little bit more easily this way. And it's so fast. You just hold down control, zoom in, zoom out. It's awesome. And finally, one of the most common awesome power user things to do on a Mac is take screenshots really quickly with, as Casey mentioned, with the Command-Shift-4 thing. And there's all the different variations of that you can use to either copy a selected region or output it directly to a file, whatever else. Any of those, including number 4, any of those that make you select a region first where you drag out the box to select, if instead you hover over a window with your mouse and you hit the space bar, it turns the cursor into a little camera, and if you click, it will capture just that window. It'll capture an image of just that window with a drop shadow behind it and nothing else. And there's some weird prefs thing you can do to disable the drop shadow if you want to. Look it up. But it's really, really nice if you want to take a screenshot of just a window to hit Command-Shift-4, whatever it is, hit space bar, click the window. It's awesome.
Yeah, that's what I usually do. There is a Command-Shift-5 now that I think is new in Catalina that lets you do some even more advanced stuff, but I always forget it exists. And it's become just such muscle memory for me to do Command-Shift-4 space. I also was thinking as you were talking, there's another one that we talked about very recently that is specific to Xcode. It is, let me get this right, it is Shift-Command-Option-Control-C. Which, what is it called in the menu? It is called Copy Qualified Symbol Name. And what that lets you do is if you have a function or a message or whatever, it will copy basically the type that it's a part of, the name of the function, and then the parameters to that function. So let's say you're putting something in, I don't know, like a GitHub PR or something like that, or a GitHub issue. You can say, foo class dot do stuff, parenthesis stuff, colon, or whatever. It's a terrible example. This is an audio show. It's very hard to describe. You get my point. It's a really, even though it's like the claw, I think that's when we were talking about it, for the whatever it was claw, the save for web claw or whatever it is. It's a very similar motion, but it's really, really convenient to get a summarized version of a method that you're working in. And I also want to double down on the control mouse wheel for Zoom. I always turn that on almost immediately, and it comes in handy every single day. John, do we have enough time to go through your list? Could you perhaps bring it down to about 100 entries if possible?
I didn't even prepare a list. I'll just go off the top of my head. First I'll amend some of your lists. So you listed the Command-Shift-4 under Finder. That's not a Finder shortcut. You can quit the Finder, and I'm pretty sure that still works.
fair.
Just to be clear on the screenshot, Command-Shift-3 is the whole screen. Command-Shift-4 is select a region or spacebar to get a window. Command-Shift-5 gives you the menu with all the options. In particular, one of the options you might be interested in if you're taking screenshots is the Command-Shift-5 thing has a little options menu that lets you set it whether you want the cursor to be visible or not. Sometimes you don't want the cursor to be visible, which I think is the default, but occasionally you do if, say, you're making a screenshot for the App Store and you're pulling down a menu. If you don't have the cursor visible, it looks like a disembodied menu coming down with no
cursor on it. Oh, that's cool. I didn't know that.
There used to be a utility, might still be there, called Grab that would give timed screenshots, but I think you can also do that from the Command Shift 5 thing now too. The reason why you'd want timed is because you want to like manipulate the UI and get it into a state where if you were to hit a keystroke, it would screw up the state. So you have a timer countdown. Anyway, lots of options for screenshotting. Paste and match style. There are a couple of apps. I think it might have been Microsoft apps. I don't want to blame them about checking, but I ran across a couple of apps or a suite of apps that didn't use the normal paste and match style keyboard shortcut. They did Command Shift V. I'm like, what the hell? Like, because I kept trying to do paste and match style, and nothing would happen. I know a lot of people who, you know, are just sick of it working this way. Remap paste and match style to Command V. If you do that, it actually covers a surprising amount of cases. Like if you, you know, so in system preferences, in the keyboard preference pane, believe it or not, there's a shortcuts area where you can set keyboard shortcuts to a corresponding menu command in any application. You just type exactly the keyboard command as it appears. Even if it's buried 20 levels deep, you just type the name, exactly, the name of the thing, which means you'll have to learn how to type an ellipsis. It's command semicolon. You may have to learn to type an ellipsis. Exactly match that text, and you can set a keyboard command. So if you do paste and match style with the same case and spacing and everything and assign it to Command V and unassign it from paste, every time you hit Command V in an application that supports paste and match file, it will paste and match style. I don't go that far. I'm so used to doing the big, you know, multi-key thing that I don't bother with, but some people do. Shortcuts that I enjoy, let's see. I'm trying to think of things that people might not know because they're old, because those are things people tend not to think about. Some of these are less reliable over the time, but they still mostly work. One of them is, since the days of classic macOS, if you begin a drag, in theory in any application, but in practice this is less and less reliable. If you begin dragging something from somewhere to somewhere, you can drag things from applications, you can drag things in the Finder, anytime you're doing a drag thing. Poor drag.
Hey!
Thing. Yeah. And you find yourself in the middle of the drag operation and you're like, I need to bail out of this. Like I've spring-loaded my way into a bunch of folders, or I've command-tabbed while I've been dragging. And there's, you know, that's another thing you can do, by the way. If you hit command-tab while you're in the middle of a drag, you can actually drag the thing you're dragging over the icon of the app you want to switch to in the command-tab switcher. There's a whole bunch of command. This is the thing about this. I don't want to be like, I can't believe people don't know this, feigned surprise. Like, oh, why does everybody not know all these shortcuts? But it really does surprise me, like, the subset of things that each person uses, right? So, like, the things that you use every day that you think everybody knows about, but then you see somebody else using a Mac, and they're using none of your things, but they're using a whole different set of things that you don't know. You know. Anyway, to finish my point about the drag, if you want to bail on that drag, it's very sometimes difficult to say, what do I do? I'm basically holding this thing in my mouse cursor, and I can't easily get back to where it was. Like it's a file or something. You want to like put it back exactly where it was, but if you don't find exactly where and you release, like it'll land on your desktop or something, and you don't want to move it to your desktop, and the Finder has undo and all sorts of other things. But anyway, trying to find a safe place to let go of a thing that you're dragging can be somewhat fraught. This happens on, we talked about this on iOS, like you begin a multi-finger drag or something, and then you're in the middle of it, and it's like, what do I do? If I release, that performs an action, but there's no safe area in the screen for me to release and say, but just don't do what I was doing. Just abort, abort. Well, on the Mac, if you hit the escape key while you were dragging, in theory, in a well-behaved Mac application, it will do exactly what you want. You're still dragging. You're still holding down the mouse button. Hit escape, and it'll just be like, oh, never mind. I'm not, whatever it is you were doing, I'm going to stop doing it. You don't have to find a safe region to dump things. If you are, by the way, looking for a safe region and escape is not supported, you can very often drag it onto the menu bar, and that will be a safe place to get rid of things. Another shortcut, again, works spottily, but I used it for many, many years and still do. If you're in a Finder window and it's in list view, and you want, like, or you have a list view Finder window, and it's filled with a bunch of folders, some of which are disclosed, some of which aren't, you know, like it's just a giant forest of folders. And you want to drag something into that folder. But anytime you drag it over the window, it starts like highlighting one of the folders. You're like, no, I don't want it to be in one of the folders that's inside this folder. I want it to be a sibling to all of those folders. I want it to just be in this window, but it's just filled with too many folders. How do I get this thing that I'm dragging into this list view Finder window, but just in the folder that window represents, not in any of the nested ones, when every single pixel that I can drag it over would have it ending up inside some other folder that's either disclosed or not disclosed? if you drag the item onto the column headings, like name, date modified, or whatever, again, in well-behaved variants of the Finder and well-behaved views and situations, that has historically been a way to drag something safely, like a safe drop region, and it will say, oh, I see you want this to be in this folder, and you're not hovering over one of the other folders that are in it, but you are within the realm of the window. So just drag it onto like the name column or whatever, and it will go into that window. Let's see. Any other good ones I can think of? There's a bunch of stuff with the option key that I do without thinking about it. In Switchglass and Front and Center, I have all these, you know, if you go to the websites for them, you can see all the different key combinations. This is very difficult to convey in the app. I don't have like an overlay that tells you about them, but basically there's tons of modifier keys that you can hit when switching windows and when clicking on things in Switchglass, and almost all those are copied from things that are already in the OS. So for example, if you hold down the option key and click on a window belonging to another application, it will hide the previous window or application behind you. Like as you leave, the thing you just left will hide, and the thing you're going to will appear. That's, you know, you can do two things in one motion that way, right? Again, combined with my applications, it, you know, modifies that behavior, but that's extremely handy. There's all the keyboard commands for doing window hiding and showing in the window menu. If you look at the window menu in most applications, they'll have like hide and hide others, command H, command option H. Very handy. Again, if you don't know those commands exist, it can sometimes be frustrating to have so many different windows, but there are commands you can type to make windows appear and disappear.
You know what really blew my mind that hearing you talk about Finder made me think of? What is the icon at the top of a window? Was it the proxy icon? Is that the right term for it? Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at a Finder window, and this is not unique to Finder, but let's pick on Finder for a second.
It's
so,
any standard document window in macOS.
Yeah, there you go. So again, I'll pick on Finder just because it's generic and everyone has it. You know, I'm looking at a folder and it happens to be called development. And so at the top of the Finder window, there's a little blue folder. Next to it, there's the word development. If you click and hold and then eventually drag that folder, you are clicking, holding, and dragging that development folder, whatever it happens to be called. So you can do things with it. And like Marco said, you know, that's also true of like a Word document or a Pages document and a whole bunch of other things. And that, I forget that exists a lot of the time, but every time I remember, it ends up saving my bacon or making something a lot easier than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, I saw some, this is me doing exactly what I said before, being shocked at things that people don't know, but there was some article, I think it was actually talking about non-obvious things in iPadOS, and they were like, yeah, well, there's a bunch of non-obvious stuff on the Mac, too. Like, I just found out recently that you can hold down the command key and click on the title of a Finder window and get a pop-up menu that shows the hierarchy, and it's like, you know, aren't people born knowing that? And the answer is no, they're not born knowing that. The only reason you notice is because you've been doing it on a Mac for umpteen million years. But if you don't already know that, it's not discoverable. And it's this thing that I rarely see people do, but old school Mac users take it for granted that you can do it. Now, this was in the context of an article saying, like, there was some feature, like, I think Gruber couldn't find, like, or thought List View didn't exist or something on the Files app on iPadOS, and like, oh, if you swipe down from the top of the screen, it shows a toolbar where you can pick the view. And he's like, how would I discover that? There's nothing on the screen indicating that I could do that. And so someone was throwing this command click on Finder title bar thing back at it. But the thing is, you don't need to know that shortcut to perform that operation in the Finder. Just by clicking with a single mouse button, you can navigate around and, you know, selecting from the menu command to go to the, you know, the computer item and drill down. Like, there, it's not the primary way to navigate in the Finder. You can never know that command click menu is in the Finder and still successfully use the Finder and use all its different views. Whereas the Files app in iPadOS, if you don't know to swipe down from the top of the screen to pull down a toolbar, you will think the app literally doesn't have a List View feature. Again, getting back to what we talked about many times in the past, the menu bar as a place to say, I don't know what this app can do. Let me look at some of the things that it can do. And you just go through all the menus and you'll see a menu called View, which you might have, you know, might be able to change the way windows look. And you'll see in View a bunch of options for different, you know, List View, icon view. And that's how you'll discover it. It totally is discoverable. The fact that, you know, there are shortcuts, and by the way, it's discoverable with the shortcuts, of course, because when you see the, you know, in the View menu, you'll see, oh, look, there's as icons, as lists, as columns, and they all have command keys. Command 1, command 2, command 3. And so not only do you learn those features exist, but you also learn the shortcuts. Yeah, I just spent all day on just some Finder ones. Command up and down arrow for navigating the hierarchy. Command option up and down arrow to hide the thing behind you. Holding the option key when you double-click a folder to, again, close the previous window behind you. This is all old school way of navigating. I know everybody uses browser mode. Anyway, I'll stop myself. I could go on for ages. But there are tons and tons of shortcuts in macOS. The help in macOS, there's some kind of help document in the built-in help that comes with the OS that is just 2 pages of shortcuts. I highly recommend people hunt that down and just read it because you'll probably learn something.
John Mitchell writes, is there a difference between using a Mac app's open whatever at login setting and its preferences versus adding it to system preferences, user and groups, login items? I feel like I'm fighting against the tide by wanting them all in one place, preferably in login items. I would assume that the open, you know, the app's own open at login setting does not necessarily need to go in login items, but I don't know of any specific differences here. So perhaps one of you guys do, maybe John.
Yeah, this is a little miniature war story because both of my applications, I wanted to have that little checkbox that says launch on login or open when I log in or whatever, because they're both the kind of application where you'd want to do that. And everyone knows login items, or everyone, whatever. A lot of people know login items. If you go to system preferences and the user and groups thing, like, and you go to your user, there's a little login items tab, and there's a list of things that are going to launch when you log in, and you can drag things into it, and a little plus minus keys, right? But sometime a couple years ago, you started to see applications, Mac applications, that would have a little checkbox in their preference that said launch on login. But then if you went to your login items, you wouldn't see it there. It'd be like, huh. Why is that not showing up there? It does launch on login. The checkbox works, but I don't see it in that thing. So when it came time for me to add launch on login to my app, my first app, Front and Center, I looked it up. Hey, how do you do launch on login? And you find a bunch of older answers that say, oh, here's how you do it. Here's how you add it to the login items list, right? It's just a plist. You just add your thing to it, and you go to system preferences. There'll be your little app icon, and it'll launch on login, right? Like so many things having to do with the Mac, the reason this changed is good old sandboxing. In a sandboxing world, it's not a situation where all these random Mac applications can access this plist that is not in their containers. The login items plist doesn't belong to any one application. It's, you know, community owned. And if you wanted to get at that plist and wanted to have the permission to edit, you'd have to throw up a permission dialog or have full disk access or do all sorts of things that sandboxing makes much more difficult. So to get around that, Apple came up with a new way for you to make your application launch on login, and it's an API that you can call. But it's not as simple as like, oh, I'll just call this API and my app will be launched on login. The API that you call, the app that you're calling it from, you cannot call that API to make the app that you're calling it from launch on login. You can only call that API to make some other app launch on login. Oh, I'm sure goodness. There's some security.
Why?
I'm sure there's some kind of security reason for this. Like, I don't understand it. I'm 100% cargo culting this. I'm Googling for the answer to my question. I'm finding it. The actual answer is you have to make another target in your application that will be a launcher application whose sole job is to launch your actual application, and you embed that inside your app bundle. So if you look inside Front and Center or you look inside Switch Glass, you will find a tiny application inside both of them called Front and Center Launcher or Switch Glass Launcher. And the only thing in the code of that application is code that will launch the real application.
So you've actually made 4 apps.
Yeah, exactly. I totally did. And then kill itself. And then from the main application, you tell the other application to tell it that it should launch your application. For the main application, you tell it to launch the launcher application on login. So the thing that's actually launching on login is not my application. It's the launcher application. And the launcher application launches, and then it launches my real application, and then my real application kills the launcher.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a hell of a, you know, this was like, I'm going to add this one little feature, right? This is why this is a miniature war story. I'm just going to add that checkbox. Really easy to do. Okay, now I just got to call whatever API to launch on login. It's like, I have to make an embedded target? What? And then how do I make sure the signing works? And then, you know, one of the many rookie mistakes I made was the deployment target for my embedded launcher was different from my application, right? I hadn't decided on the deployment targets or whatever. So if, like, the deployment target was the default, which was like 10.15 on Front and Center. So Front and Center's minimum version is like 10.12. So front and center could run on 2112, but the launcher could only run on 1015. So anyone who was running on earlier than 1015, they're like, I clicked the launch on login and it never launches, because the launcher would start to run and it would be like, oh, your version of the OS is too old. I won't run. Anyway, all this is to say the current system is bad. Having everybody group edit a random shared plist is also bad. I just hope they come up with a better system that, you know, because what you want is you want it to be secure in whatever ways they need it to be secure. You don't want to have to write an embedded launcher application, but also it would be nice to this person's point to be able to look at login items or a single place in the GUI and see here's all the things that are going to launch on login. Because now it's like dark matter. You have no idea other than by going to the application and seeing that checkbox. I don't know where to find the list of things that are configured to launch on login, but not using login items. So that is, let's say, in a transitional period, and I hope they improve it.
And finally, and this is either going to take 3 seconds or another hour, Nicholas Gaffney writes, you have to use one of your co-host's main work machines for a week with minimal changes to preferences, apps, etc. Who do you choose? Bonus, which host would you trust more to use your main Mac for a week? I will start. I will get everyone angry at me first. I think I would want to use Marco's iMac Pro because I think it's going to be most similar to my own setup. Now, I saw John unmute, so I have a feeling he's about to argue with me.
But, say, how dare you? How dare you?
My screen
is bigger and brighter.
Yes.
I have more internal storage. I have more cores.
You have more RAM.
Yeah, and you have more RAM. I'm too scared of your setup, though, John. Like, look at you. Why do you have a second dock in the corner of your screen? There's no need for that. You don't need that, John. You don't need it.
You don't need to see it. The screen's so big, it'll be in your peripheral vision.
So
you can turn on auto hide.
Yeah, that's also true. So I think it is most likely, because it's been a long time, but I've seen Marco's computer and I've seen him use it very, very briefly, and it looked like a reasonably vanilla macOS installation, so to the point that I feel like I could work with it. Whereas I think John is probably customizing his setup, you know, to the ends of the earth and back, and it scares me. And more important than anything else, I think John would be a lot less forgiving to me changing anything on his computer, whereas not to say Marco would be excellent about this, but I think Marco, you would be more forgiving about me changing things if necessary. Who would I trust most to use my main Mac for a week? I am actually going to continue to pick on John and say I would trust Marco because I think John would not be able to control himself.
Fix it is what
that's
I would
the thing. John yeah, would not be able to control
but
himself.
But it would be fixed when I was done.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, by whose definition of fixed?
Exactly.
Well, as in you'd be able to use it to record podcasts without it screwing up in the middle.
Ooh, sick burn.
That's what
sick
I mean. Burn. Like, I'm not meaning I would change your settings. I mean I would debug your problem.
All right, if that's the case, if that's the deal, then I'll switch my answer to John. But in general, I'm too scared that, and I think Marco knows exactly where I'm coming from, I'm too scared that you would fix it for the definition of now I'm running front and center and switch glass, and I've got all sorts of things. I've got Perl installed.
I would fix your scroll. I would change your scroll direction to the
monster.
I mean, it says minimal changes to settings. I think we're allowed to change the scroll direction if any of us are using the terrible quote-unquote natural direction.
You mean the correct direction, which is
wrong.
Natural. Anyway, that is my answer. All right, Marco, it's your turn to get picked on. What would you do?
I was basically going to say you for both of those exact same reasons. In both directions, you using my computer, me using your computer for the exact same reasons of, like, you know, I do run a fairly vanilla setup, and I think John runs a much more customized one than either of us. And so both I would both want my setup to be altered as little as possible. And I think if John was using my computer, I think he would have a lot more complaints, and that would result in him
John?
Fixing my computer. And and secondly, I wouldn't want to use his because I'd be afraid of messing it up.
Yep.
But you'd both be on guest accounts. It's not like you'd be on my account. Like, it says it doesn't specify, but I'm assuming it means like you're not using that person's account. Like, you'd have your own account.
No, I took it as you know, obviously we would never want to share passwords or whatever, but in this hypothetical scenario, I am sitting down on the Marco user on Marco's computer or the John user on John's computer, whatever the case may be. And so I am literally using your setup.
But then if we don't have each other's passwords, then how would we update our Apple ID settings, which would be prompted for at least once or twice during the week.
That's a fair point. I guess.
Are you both getting that prompt, or is that just me?
Just you.
No. Yeah, it comes up occasionally. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Oh yeah.
It'll be like a notification that says your Apple ID settings need to be updated, and if you click on it, it will launch system preferences, and it will go to the Apple ID thing, and there'll be a thing that says you need to update your thing, and then it'll make you enter your Apple ID password, and then you wait a little bit, and then it'll make you enter your Mac password, and you wait a little bit, and then it goes away.
I have had that happen for sure, but it doesn't happen as frequently as it sounds like yours does.
I kept meaning to ask about this on Twitter, but I'll do it now on the podcast. If you work for Apple on iCloud and you know what the hell that thing is, please tell us. Because I do it every, few weeks. And every time I do it, I'm like, what are you doing, thing? I haven't changed anything related to my Apple ID. I don't know what you're prompting me for. I mean, okay, I'll enter my Apple ID password and then I'll enter my Mac password and then you'll go away. But I don't know why you were ever here. And it makes me think it's server related, because I think like when Catalina first came out, there was a day where everyone was getting prompted for it like 100 times a day. Like you'd do it and then it would come back 5 minutes later, right? And I'm like, this has got to be a server side thing, because this is not client side. Anyway, so if you know what that is definitively and can tell us, and as an extra credit can tell us if there's anything we can do about stopping it, although I assume there isn't because I assume it's a server side thing, please tell us.
All right, John, so who's getting in trouble?
Well, I think this is what's going on said, but I'll say it. No one wants to use Casey's computer because it's broken all the time. no one has picked your computer yet. I know it's just Mark.
No, I did.
But I'm also not going to. It's just three of us, so there's limited choices. I can't pick my own computer, and I'm sure as hell not going to pick yours because nothing works. Like the OS constantly has to be reinstalled, and the trackpad is stuttering, and you can't record podcasts not on right it. And now. Who wants to use? And then when it was working, you can't do Swift UI with the live preview because it's on Mojave. Like no one wants to use that thing.
Oh, come on, man.
What? I mean, that's true. Like, and I was assuming we would be on our own account, so I'd have to say I'd be on Margo's. And like honestly, I don't customize my computer. Like there's. I have fewer menu bar icons than you do, Casey. So there's that, right? I mean, what if I look at my menu bar right now, I've got Mountain, PaceBot, my two apps, Twitterific, and the stupid Skype thing that I can't get rid of. And then I have Time Machine, Wi-Fi, like sound, and then the sidecar thingamabobber, plus like my name and the date. Like I'm not running any kind of system extensions other than I think I'm running Typinator as my autocomplete thingy. Is there anything else? No, I mentioned PasteBot. That's it. I customize new folder to Command N in the Finder because I'm a sane person, and I have the proper scroll direction. Like that's the extent of my direction. Customization. Like it's not that weird. Anyway, I'd pick Marco's. I've used Marco's computer briefly. I would really dislike his mouse, but. what can you do? And his weird keyboard, I can't type on split keyboards, but I would survive. But I have some confidence that it would stay up and be reliable during the time that I was forced to use it.
You're so mean to me. Hey, this computer hasn't barfed yet in the last 2 hours, 10 minutes, and 24 seconds.
You may have solved the problem.
Yeah, maybe.
That problem.
We'll see. Yeah, right.
Yeah, now I feel like this question is limiting because like there's only three of us, so you only have the choice of two other things, and one of them is Casey's computer in our case. So.
Wow.
I just can't believe neither one of you picked this thing because it is a champion.
It's because of you, John. Because of you.
You use a guest account. There's limited damage you can do.
Mm-hmm. Also, the other problem at using your computer, John, is that I might get used to the 6K. And then I'd have to buy one, and I really don't want that to happen.
No, you'll totally get used to it. Like I mentioned the day that I got it, it was like it was so big I don't know where to look, and then it just becomes normal so fast. And then I go to my wife's iMac, I'm like, what is this little 12-inch computer here? It's not that much smaller, but I go over to it, and it looks small. Like the chin looks bigger, the screen looks smaller. It's so depressing how instantly you get used to even a slightly bigger screen. I do wonder what the limits are, though. Like, I feel like if 42 inches at this distance, would that be outside my peripheral vision?
Oh, my goodness.
I could use more height.
Oh, my goodness.
Thanks to our sponsors this week, Squarespace, Collide, and Away. And we will talk to you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. Cause it was accidental. Accidental. Oh, it was accidental. Accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. Cause it was accidental. Accidental. Oh, it was accidental. Accidental. And you can find the show notes at ATP.
Free.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC, USA Syracuse. It's accidental.
So in the last 24, 48 hours, there has been a discovery, maybe an announcement about a new BMW logo. Now, it is not clear to me, maybe it's clear to others, that is this just for their new i4, which is like their new electric car, or is this going to be embraced across the line? I'm not sure. If you look at the image, we'll put a link in the show notes. If you look at the image as presented next to the current logo, it looks like garbage, but when you see it on the hood of a car, I don't think it looks bad. And I seem to be in the minority. I think pretty much everyone hates it, but I think it's pretty good. I like it a lot more than I like the flattened Volkswagen logo, which just does not look right to me. John, how do you feel about this?
So it is, first of all, I think it is official everywhere. If you go to the actual BMW page and not the umpteen stories about it, you'll see their explanation, presumably translated from German. And they show the history of their logo. Here's the good. The good is the BMW logo has not changed much over the years. It's always been a little circle with the propeller thing in it. It's got the letters BMW. And it's basically been the same. They've changed the details of, like, are there little rings around the rings and what color are the letters and how dark blue are the little propeller things on the inside. But it hasn't changed that much. The new one, exactly the same shape, letters BMW, the propeller thing, right? The difference is that, and they don't say this in the thing, but it's, I can see in the application of the logo, the outer ring that says BMW is basically now transparent, like a transparent ping. Whatever the background is shows through, and the ring around the outside is white, and the letters are white, and the propeller is still blue and white, and then everything else is transparent. So when they put it on the car, you see body color through the ring. But when you see it in their little logo thing, it shows it next to a bunch of other logos where that ring used to be black. And they put it on a gray background. So what you see is a gray ring with white letters and then the propeller in the middle. And I think that looks bad. Not super bad, because it's still, like, it's basically the same logo. It's not like they stylized it and made it all 90s and added drop shadows or whatever. It's fairly straightforward, but it's weaker. It has lower contrast. It has less personality, and it looks somewhat incomplete. When you see it on a car and the body color shows through, it can kind of look cool depending on the body color. Now, suddenly, the body color you choose for your car influences how the logo looks. In context on the car, I still think it looks mostly okay, especially, like, did you see the new i logo? They have a new logo for the i.
Oh, no,
series of cars in it. It's a nice matchup for that. It's all very 2D and flat. Like, if you look at the last logo revision they did in 1997, it's filled with 3D shading and all sorts of sort of, people would say skeuomorphic details, but they don't know what the word skeuomorphic means. But it looks like iOS 6, let's put it that way. The 1997 logo looks like iOS 6, and the new logo doesn't look like iOS 7, but it's closer. Everything is flat, there is no shading, everything is solid color. I am not sold on the transparency. I think someone came up with that idea and thought it was, interesting and clever and convinced people it was a good idea. I am not convinced it's a good idea.
Yeah, because, like, you know, you mentioned how, like, this logo, progress image here showing it against a gray background, and it doesn't look good against gray. You know, it's a really common color for cars.
It's so true.
Shades of gray.
Or what is it going to look like on white?
Right. Like, I think it has a pretty good chance of looking good on black, because that will most closely approximate the way it's looked forever.
But it'll be weird, though, because the black will be sunken, because that'll be, like, body metal. Like,
yeah, like, I think it'll look okay on black and very dark colors. It might look okay on straight white, but it probably won't look good on any silver or medium gray, which they sell a lot of. And yeah, I don't know. It's just, I see this, and I think, this is an interesting idea to change the logo, to modernize it, but this isn't how I would have done it. And I don't think it works. I don't think it's successful. I don't think it looks good. The good news is that when you see it on the i4, the rest of the i4 is so hideous looking that you immediately forget about the logo.
That's not so bad.
It's all
right. It
looks better than the bad. i3.
Well, the grill is truly and utterly terrible. Like, the grill, it's not quite Lexus bad, but it is right on the edge of Lexus bad.
But in the grand scheme of ugly grills, have you seen, like, the new Genesis grills? And, like, there's a whole bunch of just really awful grills that are coming out. The i4 is not great, but, like, of all of the usually awful BMW concept car treatments of the kidney grill, this one is about middle of the road, because I've seen some worse ones. But yeah, this is a big trend, and I don't understand it, because like in the i4, the actual physical trend is you don't need air coming in when you have electric cars, so why do you need a big gaping hole in the front? And yet people still want to put a big gaping hole, and they plug it, like the first Tesla Model S, with this big black thing that says, yeah, there's a hole here, but we don't need the hole, so let's put a plug in it. Tesla figured that out, at least fairly quickly, and said, no, we're not going to do that. But all these other companies, their signature is the front grill, or they want it to be the front grill. Like Lexus, their new design trend of having this massive gaping mesh thing in the front. Genesis with the similar style, where they're trying to define their style by this massive gaping grill. This is not the time to have a huge grill. You know, when you go electric, it's going to be pointless. Don't make that your brand identity.
You know, I'm watching, this is now on the BMW Concept i4 page. There's a 30-second video. I didn't realize that in the ridiculously huge grill, it says i4 within it, which is whatever, fine. It lights up like the god-awful, terrible Mercedes logos that light up.
I'm seeing that now. Oh, that's bad.
I mean, this is not the actual car. This is a concept car.
I know.
But the Mercedes logo, ship that.
Yeah, the Mercedes logo is so bad when it's illuminated. Like, the regular Mercedes logo as is fine. It's good. I like it. But illuminating it is just a, look at me and my fancy-ass Mercedes. Aren't I cool?
I feel like Mercedes has BMW has the wisdom to not change their logo radically, but even now I feel like they're giving in a little bit. Mercedes, like, understands you can do lots of different treatments with the three-pointed star, but don't one day say, you know what, we're adding a fourth point, or we're making the star fatter or whatever. Like, it's more or less, but if you saw the Mercedes, like, three-prong logo, it would look like the BMW thing, and like, over the years, it more or less stays the same. But if you look at any individual Mercedes, there's wide variations in how they treat that logo, and I feel like BMW had the same advantage, and that they had lots of, their logo was a little circle that was basically a neutral colored black circle with letters BMW and a slight accent of blue in the middle. And that was fine, and it matched everything, and it looked good. Like, it was not broken. It did not need to be fixed.
Yeah. It says BMW Concept i4. It is lit up in the grill. It is lit up. The yeah. word BMW.
I'm thinking that's not going to ship.
I hope not. But I mean, would you want to drive a billboard? I mean, the illuminated Mercedes logo makes me so angry. But this is so much worse.
Well, a lot of cars have shipped with the thing where you open the door and it projects like the name of the car company or the model onto the ground. Yeah. Have you seen those?
Oh God,
yeah, cars shipped with that. That's not just a concept car thing, but yeah, if you look at this concept car, there's a lot of those things in this car that are not shipping for sure.
Yeah, I hope not.
It's also too bad to me, because one of the things that I always admire BMW for, which is silly, but I really thought their angel eyes were amazing. So if you're not familiar, early on, it was maybe late 90s or something like that. I don't remember exactly when, but BMW headlights, they for a long time were four circles. And what they did is they had like a ring around the outside of each of the headlights that would light up. And that was their daytime running lights. And they called them angel eyes. And they were, to my recollection anyway, the first manufacturer to do a treatment of their lights, particularly daytime running lights, that was a signature thing, right? So you saw those four circles coming at you. You knew that was a BMW. And it was within 5 or 10 years that basically every other auto manufacturer in the world started doing the same thing. But they seem to have given up on the four circles. And I suppose that probably makes sense from a technological point of view. But to me, I actually almost feel like, especially in the age of electric cars, coming back to what you were saying, John, like, can the kidney grill, like, yes, I know that's blasphemous, but can the kidney grill and keep the angel eyes? But now they've got lights that don't look too dissimilar from my Golf. I don't know.
They still do the four lights. Like, that's still their signature, is the four lights, not the fact that they're circular. I mean, just look at the i4. Like, when you see headlights on a BMW, it's always each headlight has two major distinct things.
Yeah, but to me, it was so cool.
I'm with you, Casey. Like, I think they, like, here we are talking about they changed the logo, And yet they kept this giant kidney grill that is totally unnecessary on this car. By the way, it has an air intake. It's below the kidney grill. That it's like they're like in that little slot. Like, but like that's there is an air intake there, but the grill isn't it, which is even more ridiculous that they have this ridiculous styling element here. Like, I think if they're going to change something that's been long, you know, this long-standing icon of their brand, drop the kidney grill from electric cars that don't need it.
You're both fired. They can't drop the kidney. That's the defining styling element of the entire brand. You cannot drop that. You can make it. You can decide to minimize it instead of maximizing it. Instead of in every model, make it bigger instead of smaller. That's what I was getting at before. But I don't think you need to drop it, especially since at various times, if you look at the 850, you can make the kidneys really small, smaller than the openings that are smaller than the little T in the Model S and the current Tesla. Even like, it's not a problem for like you can't use the kidneys if you have an electric car. All I was saying is if you know you're not going to need air intake, don't keep making those kidneys bigger and bigger because that's dumb and it doesn't look good. That's the whole point. It doesn't look good. It's perfectly fine to keep the kidneys, just, you know, find a way to make them look nice, because now that's all they have to do is look nice. They have to look nice and not add too much drag. I actually like the headlights on this i4 concept. You know, they're like angel under eye lids, use shapes,
angel
or whatever.
Bags under their eyes.
I think that's actually a fairly, you know, I don't, again, I don't think that's going to ship as is, but it's a fairly nice aggressive looking headlight that still looks like BMW to me. If I could just blank out the giant schnoz in the middle there, if I could blank out that kidney or replace it with a smaller kidney, I like the way the front of this car looks. The back, much less so.
Yeah, it's the grill is just so bad.
And we have a concept car. You're going to pick brown? That's the color. I know they're going to call it gold, but this is not.
They call it champagne or something.
It's not a looker.
No.